Hello and welcome to episode 20 of Crate and Crowbar. It's being recorded on the 26th of November. I'm Marsh Davis and I'm joined by my three fellow crow-laborators.
Oh,
Graham Smith.
Hello.
Tom Francis.
Hello.
And Tom Sr.
You alright?
Alert listeners of this podcast may have noticed that there's something different this week, which is namely that we have a nice musical tune to play us in. And it was provided to us by a local swing band called The Mandibles, who are very good. The full track is called Clambake, and there'll be a link to it and the Bandcamp page for the band in the show notes. If you like that, you'd also be advised to check out another band, which is formed from many of the same members, which is more of a going concern, called Count Bobo and the Bullion, which plays in many of our favourite boozing establishments.
We happened to see them live just a couple of weeks ago, wasn't it? Unintentionally.
No, indeed.
They were good.
And they're very good. So, I'll drop another link for that in the show notes, and you should definitely, if you're in the Bath area, go and see them sometime. Anyway, computer games, eh? We've been playing some. We've all been playing games from the IGF.
Yeah, lots of them. There's been some... What do you think, Marsh and Graham and Tom?
Very inclusive.
I'm trying to remember who is an IGF judge and who's been playing them. But some people I've talked to say that this isn't a good year for the IGF. For me, it has been, in terms of the stuff I've played. I've played a bunch of really cool stuff. But do you think that?
I haven't played or explored enough yet to know whether it's a great year. It doesn't feel maybe as good as it was 2 years ago, but then I kind of had this feeling about last year's. Like, there was a rule change just before last year's where they said that if your game was nominated for an award, you couldn't resubmit it. Mm. That was in response to, I think, Fez being put in again and then winning awards a second time around. And I think that caused a lot of people not to submit their unfinished game because they wanted to give it the best chance possible of winning. And I think what that's done is it's made that a situation, and this is helped on by early access and that kind of thing, but a situation where the very best games in the IGF, this isn't the first time we're playing them, as it would have been the case for games like FTL or that kind of thing a few years ago. And in fact, many more of the games in the IGF are games that are already released. And so I think that creates an impression of this isn't that good a year for the IGF, when actually the games that are in there are great. There's lots of great games in there, like Kerbal Space Program, like Risk of Rain that you're about to talk about, and so on.
Risk of Rain was actually a discovery for me, because I think it was released right around the time that judging started. It hasn't been out for long anyway. I think it was November. And it was... Someone recommended it to me one day, saying, oh, if you like roguelikes like Spelunky, or polished roguelikes like Spelunky, you'll like Risk of Rain. And then the next day I was assigned it as a judge in the IGF. Hey, you should play Risk of Rain. And then like two other people mentioned it randomly to me, like, oh, you should play Risk of Rain. I'm like, okay. And sure enough, it's really good, but I almost gave up on it forever. It was only because I was actually assigned to judge it that I persevered with it. Because it completely misleads you about how to play. It tells you that on easy mode, your progress isn't saved, which is a weird message for a roguelike, because like, progress isn't saved anyway, right? When you die, you start at the beginning. It's a side-scrolling, more of a shooter than Spelunky. It's, you know, actually about dealing damage to big mobs of enemies using four different skills. And when you die, you start again at the beginning. So, like, progress? The only progress that I could see was you unlock characters. You start off with only one choice of characters, and eventually there's, like, 10. And so I'm like, well, I don't want to play on the mode where you can't unlock any characters, because, like, the one thing I'm not wild about, really, is that I can only play as this one guy, and three of his attacks, so he just shoots people. And his fourth attack is he dodges, which is fine, but it's not that interesting. And if there's 10 other characters, I want to unlock those, so I've got to play on medium. And then medium is just brutally, absurdly difficult. You just can't get anywhere on it. And the difficulty is constantly rising, like, even if you don't leave the first level, the difficulty rises with time rather than with progress. So it's just always getting harder all the time, and you just have to run, kill, do not ever stop or pause or explore or anything. And so it's incredibly stressful. The class that you start with is pretty dull, and it seemed like it was just, I was never going to unlock anything like that. You can see what you need to do to unlock the things, and it's like, complete the game 5 times to unlock this one. Or, in the fifth world, find the secret crate and open it and defeat the boss. I'm like, no, that's not going to happen. I went down the list and like there was almost none that were ever feasible. But it turns out, if you play on easy, you can unlock those characters. And easy is significantly easier. It's still challenging for a new player. Still difficult to get anywhere. But you get to actually play around with it enough to understand that, oh, it's not actually super... time sensitive. Like, you don't have to race to the exit exactly. It's more about kind of keeping your own character level in balance with the enemy level, making sure you're always killing things and always leveling up a little bit, so that you don't fall behind the curve.
Because enemies just spawn in all the time, right?
Yeah, so even if you stay on level one, they'll just keep on spawning in forever.
And right next to you as well, disconcertingly.
But then it's quite, you become sort of grateful for that at times, because you need to be leveling up all the time. If you start walking around the level and nothing spawns, you're like, ah, come on guys, you've got to spawn, I need to kill you. Because if I fall behind, it gets really difficult. And it's very random. The most interesting thing about it is that, you know how a Spelunky playthrough can be different because that crate had a shotgun in it, and now your whole game is about, I can kill anything really easily, but I can't solve jumping puzzles very easily, so I've got to be careful. Mm. And then next game you might get a cape, and that helps with jumping puzzles. This is like that, only like you are finding passive bonuses all the time. So there's crates all over the place, you pay to unlock them, you pay in-game money that you just get from enemies. And they are all containing things that, like, an item that will do, it'll heal you a bit every time you deal damage. But it'll be a very small amount. So it'll be like, I don't know, 1 hit point for every 10 hit points of damage you deal or something. And then if you find several of those, then they stack. And there's more than 100 different items. And they range from like small buffs like that. Some of them just increase your health. Some of them, just have very basic benefits. But then some of them are really interesting. One of them, adds a bar next to your character that fills up the more money you're currently carrying, and at maximum you do 40% more damage. So you do more damage the richer you are at all times. And it means like you still want to, you always want to gain money, but now you don't want to spend the money. Now you want to kind of like wait at least until the end of the level before you buy anything. So you go through the whole level just killing things and refusing to spend it on any of the cool, like, you find drones that you can pay to repair that follow you around, and shops where you can buy stuff, and then crates that you have to pay to open. And so it incentivizes you to like leave all those alone, keep accumulating gold, kill everything, and then just before you leave, run back and open all these crates and stuff. But then as you're doing that, if they're all over the map, and it takes you a long time to climb around the map, and like you have to climb up ladders and stuff, and it takes a while, you suddenly start to realize, I'm not killing anything at the moment, and time is ticking away, and the difficulty is rising as I'm doing this. So there's all these kinds of interesting dynamics like that. I had one build where I had loads of drones with me, which fire automatically. I had a bunch of toxic worms that mean all the damage I deal does damage over time, as well as the normal damage. And then I found a thing called, like, I think it was like the death mask or the laughing mask, and it means every enemy you kill comes back as a ghost that fights for you for like 5 seconds. So everything you kill, you're killing like sometimes 100 enemies in a couple of seconds, and they all come back as an army that fights for you. And I also had like a thing that would randomly fire off missiles, randomly fire off mortars, and then a deployable missile launcher that would like fire off like 7 heat-seeking missiles from my back that I could only use every 30 seconds. And it meant that I could just dip into a big mob of enemies and kill a couple of them, and then some of them would be poisoned, some of them would be dead, some of them would be getting hit by missiles and mortars, and then the ones that died came back as ghosts, and they wouldn't be able to kill all the rest of them because there'd only be like 10% of them, but they'd kill some, and those ones came back as ghosts, and then those ones came back as ghosts, and they would like cascade into like the whole mob basically killing itself. It was so cool. And that's just a random, you know, accumulation of all these different things that I picked, that I happened to find on that particular playthrough.
Are the levels randomized?
No, weirdly. Like, the position of everything in them is. So the exit, the entrance, the enemies, right, the treasure you find is all randomly placed, so you can't guarantee anything will be there. But there's only like 2 options for level 1 and 2 options for level 2. It's really weird, because it's been, I think it's been in development for quite a long time. They had like a running beta and things, and I was watching like an old beta video today on YouTube, and it's, you know, the same level I'm playing in the final version. I guess they only made like, what, 6 levels or 8 levels or something, which is very strange, because they don't even like, they have a couple of like jumping puzzles in them where, okay, you can only get up here if you leap from this rope to that rope. But for the most part, they feel kind of awkwardly designed, a little bit annoying sometimes.
Yeah, there's just the kind of gap between platforms that you may not anticipate correctly and fall off. Just slightly annoying.
Yeah, I don't know why they didn't randomize levels. I feel like I could write a random level generator for this, because it's such a simple, it's just big block
platforms.
They don't
look amazing either, so it's not like Well, no, I mean, the reason I mentioned this is because I bounced off the game almost instantaneously and uninstalled it after like 10 minutes because I'm very judgmental. But I should have persisted, because having watched one of your videos for one of your playthroughs, it clicked with me what the game was about and what kind of, because I didn't understand what my objectives were. So I was just kind of standing still saying, right, okay, what have I got to do here? And all these creatures are spawning in and just getting increasingly tougher. And I was just, well, you know, this is impossible, isn't it? I mean, yeah.
Yeah, I fortunately watched Tom's video before playing it. So instantly understood, like, the mechanic of, like, the difficulty mechanic isn't that apparent initially. There's a small bar that ticks upwards all the time on the top right, and you can see that, like, the difficulty level is listed.
You mean you didn't hear the church bells chime? Exactly, the difficulty was going up.
Yeah, it's the sort of sound that can easily be lost in the middle of the melee when you're being swarmed by a dozen giant, glowing, radioactive, giant monster things.
And a lot of the monsters you can walk straight past, right?
Mm.
Which didn't occur to me. I just assumed I would die if I touched them, like in, you know, Spelunky or something, you know, so... yeah, that makes it a lot harder if you're trying to physically avoid all the enemies.
All of them you can walk through, and there's a boss that's a giant monster that lives in lava, and my ways of defeating him is as a player's like an acid monster who can leave a trail of acid where he walks, and a legitimate tactic is to jump into the lava and lay your acid inside the lava, walking straight through the boss as he rampages back and forth, and then jump back out and let it do damage over time. So yeah, it's quite counterintuitive sometimes.
Yeah, I have suicided off the bottom of the map sometimes to escape mobs and kind of...
Yeah, because you just spawn again, like, nearby.
No damage any or anything, it just teleports you to a safer location. Sometimes in the middle of a huge fight. But I did really enjoy the stacking passive benefits that you get.
Yeah.
That's, for me, the main reason to play it. So I got as far as 40 minutes in, and managed to unlock two characters in one kind of monstrous Incredirun. So I did the thing where I bust open the crate on World 5, and then you have to fight this weird slime monster. And then once you fought that dude, you get him as a character that you can play as in the future and that kind of thing. But by the end, every enemy I killed exploded. every enemy I damaged left a trail of fire in their wake when they died as well. Every enemy I killed healed me. My money ticked up once every second, just permanently, forever. So I was constantly rich, and there are these kind of gambling shrines that you come across where you could just... spam money at them, and they might give you nothing at all, or they might give you another one of these passive buffs. So you never ever use them because they're rubbish.
They get more expensive each time you use them as well, like they almost double in price, I think, every time you use them.
Yeah, so if you're actually on an ordinary economy, you'd never ever touch them, but the passive buffs kind of break the economy for you in a way that actually makes those viable. So if you're earning so much money that you can't get rid of it, the money is converted into experience once you go through the portal at the end of each level, but it doesn't give you much experience. You're much better off spamming them at kind of imp shrines, which is kind of spawn a load of imps you have to kill in order to get passive buffs, or are these gambling shrines that could give you something amazing or nothing.
There's another really cool item you can find. It's called Snake Eyes, and it's a pair of dice, and it has no effect except when you use shrines, and every time you fail a shrine, the dice ticks up one, and each time it ticks up, it increases your critical chance, so the chance of doing critical hits, and I think it's quite significant per tick, but if you ever succeed at a shrine, you lose it all. So the more you fail, the more powerful you become. So then the shrines like completely flip on the head, because now you're hoping you won't get an item each time you use it. Like, I'm going to pay $50, hope I don't get an item. And you don't. Yes, I failed. Like, $75, hope I don't get an item. Like, ah, yes, you fail. And then like the fifth time it gets you an item, and it's a really good item, and you're like, oh, come on! Fuck you for giving me something.
I think it's really clever in the way that it's the passive buffs that you get alter other systems, like, constantly. So, like you say, you've got the money gauge where it's for you do more damage. So that combined with the thing that ticks up money constantly is just a fantastic combination.
There's
the drone repairer thing. If you have four drones with you, I had three with me at the time, at the end of my 40-minute run, the worst thing that can happen is that they get broken, but you can repair them constantly and actually keep your own personal army.
There's also a gold bomb, which just drops half of your money in a bomb. It's an awesome idea, but unfortunately I don't think it's balanced right, because I've had a lot of money and used it, and it's still pathetic damage. Like, it's just it doesn't amplify it enough for it to actually be worth it. But I think it's like one hit point per gold piece or something, or per dollar that you spend. But I think it's just like a silly ostentatious item. Like, if you're really, really rich, then you just blow up your gold.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. That it, like, you'd never know how good it was by looking at it or watching a video of it. It's kind of really hard to sell why it's fun. And it doesn't look great. Like, if you see screenshots of this, it's like all the dudes are tiny and it's just flat, bland.
Yeah, it's very kind of Spartan. I don't think it's ugly, actually. I think it is, there's a certain kind of beauty to it, but it's really kind of
It makes sense later on when you're being swarmed by so many enemies. That's when you realize, that's why you're so pulled out.
It's a lot like Knit, I think, the graphical style. Mm. Those big, very rectangular platforms that are kind of artificial, but the actual kind of like, I don't know, just the colouring of them and the kind of choice of like just this little bit of grass or this little like vine growing somewhere gives it a lot of atmosphere.
I actually found watching videos of it did sort of sell it in a way that even playing it doesn't seem to. I mean, the fact that you bounced off it and you, Tom, struggled with it a little bit at first, and every single person I've spoken to pretty much has said, I didn't really get it for like at least the first.
Well, I think it would have just been as simple as there being some explanation of your objective or some kind of suggestion of strategy. Mm-hmm. Because without that, if you try and play it like you would some other kind of platformer where enemies don't spawn in continuously, then you're just going to get pretty boned very quickly.
I wish that more games had kind of menu screens or press start screens like old Nintendo games because they were videos that showed you what you were about to do in the game.
Yeah.
And, you know, Mario jumping around and bouncing into the bottom of a block and then picking up a mushroom, and then you go, oh, I can do that. That's what I'm about to do in this game I'm going to play. And most games don't have that. Most games just drop you in. It's intimidating to overcome the initial stages of what the fuck is this, and most people don't overcome that stage, hence YouTube videos and Let's Plays existing and being really useful.
But do you see that GIF that Dan Marshall posted of Assassin's Creed?
Yeah, yes. I did. Yeah.
Where I'll describe it anyway, because this will make no sense until you know what it depicts at least, but it's just someone playing Assassin's Creed 4 Black Flag. They're on their ship, they've like got their grappling hooks into an enemy ship, and they run up to the rope that's on the side of the ship and swing from that onto the enemy ship and do a sort of aerial attack where they stab two dudes, I think with their hidden blades, like from the air, kill them both. And then someone runs towards them and they pull out a pistol and shoot them, and then run up to the like helm of the ship and start sword fighting with one guy, but then another guy's about to shoot him. About to shoot at him. So he takes that guy as a human shield to take the shot of the guy who's about to shoot him. And then that kills that dude. Then he shoots the guy with a gun, hacks up another two people, and then switches back to the guy with a gun and just kicks him off the edge of the ship. And all these things are just like, they're just standard moves. The game's really good at making these fights cinematic, and all he's doing is just not screwing it up. He's just doing all the cool things the game lets him do. And it's like 7 seconds long. You watch it and think, fucking hell, I want to play that game. It looks so fucking good. And it only works because you know it's a guy just playing the game. He's just playing the game. This is not a cinematic. It's not scripted. Mm. It's, you know, all of the things he's doing are just things you can do in this video game. And it's completely authentic too. It's a, like, the reason it sells the game is because the game is genuinely really good. But I don't think it would ever occur to Ubisoft to release a trailer where it's just someone playing the game for 7 seconds and playing really, really well.
Yeah.
And just saying, hey, this is a guy playing our game. That's it.
One of the other IGF entries that I know some of us have played had a similar problem in that its trailer was, it's a perfectly fine trailer. It's just that it's completely non-instructive in what the game is at all. The game being Jazz Punk. And you watch this trailer and it's just this cacophony of different things happening, weird noises, flashing lights, and you're just like, slightly fearful now. But, what the game actually is, in fact, it goes back to the ideal setting that you were talking about, on the previous podcast where you said you wanted something set in the world of kind of Cold War espionage.
Yes.
And technically that's what this is, although possibly not in the way you might anticipate. It's a alternative 1950s in which everybody is a robot, I think.
I played it, I didn't even know that.
But it also seems to be filtered through, the medium of Hanna-Barbera cartoons and Airplane, and possibly some very heady narcotics. And it's, everything in it is just completely a joke. Like every single interaction that you have in it is some kind of setup for something.
Something I haven't really seen that much in games, which is throwaway gags.
Mm.
You know, like Airplane, there'll just be stuffed into every scene that's funny in itself, but relates to nothing else. Like there's a bit, you're just in a building and you come out of this door and on the wall is a fire alarm, and right next to it there's an ice alarm. That's it, that's the joke. It means nothing, has nothing to do with anything.
And you set it off, the plumes of fire emerge from the ceiling. you get given a mission by your boss who looks like, are they meant to be robots? It's hard to tell. All of them. Yeah.
Because there's one where you walk up to them in the courtyard and they've got a
pull string on their back.
Yeah.
And that's how you activate NPC dialogue. It's NPCs, you pull them and they say their line.
Everything that they say appears in front of them in captions. And the game plays with this by sometimes having the captions contradict what they're saying. And it's just what they're saying may be funny in itself, but there's also an additional joke of your interaction with them being somehow subverted. Like everything, like just jumping. If you jump off an object, you land on the ground and it goes boing, and it's like everything is just, I don't know.
What do you do in it? Like, you just described like a 60 different fucking hits, which all sound like funny jokes. Well, what is it about?
That's how that trailer got made.
you have an objective, which is to infiltrate the Russian embassy. And
it's a first person some data. Game.
Yes, sorry. Yes, it is a first person game. But what that amounts to is essentially you get given an environment you can walk around in, and you have these just little interactive vignettes at every kind of possible opportunity. So you walk across a bridge and accidentally knock somebody to their death in traffic, and he screams, or there's a frog who you can steal IPs for by wearing a visor, and you play a little frog again.
I've missed most of this.
There's just like a pizza in a box in a back alley. If you look at it, it opens up this kind of pizza-shaped laptop, and then it goes into this extended pizza/Evil Dead minigame. it's really fucking strange. I don't think I've laughed as much, actually. Yeah, really, it had me in tears at one point.
I want to stress that I saw the trailer and it interested me a little bit, but I was like, yeah, it kind of just looks like one of those nuts things. Like, there are a lot of games that are just nuts. They're just a series of surreal images that make no sense and do nothing and go nowhere. And some of them are interesting, but most of them aren't. And so I wasn't super interested in playing it. And then I just looked at its page on IGF and, like, just sounded like when they're talking about the humour aspect of it, I didn't even realise it was meant to be funny. And so I played it, and it's really funny. And it's actually much more of a kind of straight satire / comedy than it is a surreal game. Like, there's surreal things in it. Most of them are in service of a joke. And there's just stuff like you're running out of a restaurant and you barge past some guards and they topple like Skittles and they make the noise of Skittles as they fall down. And the next bunch of guards you find are just Skittles. And then one of them just says, bowling joke.
Yeah.
I didn't actually play it myself, but we all in the office gathered around watching one person play it, watching Andy play it. And it was just like, it was a brilliant kind of communal thing as well. It was like watching Airplane. The gags are so thick and fast. And I think I found it delightful, really, that a game could exist purely to deliver jokes. And I think that's a pretty viable way of entertaining players.
Something great happened to me in it. I don't know if it was an intentional joke, so I'd like to know if it happened to you guys as well. But there's a scene where the way you get past a guard is to change a clock to like a point when people will be off duty or something. It involves a lot of messing around with the clock, and I was just messing around with the clock, incorrectly for a long time. And when I turned around, the guard who I was trying to get past was right in my face. Like, he'd just been standing right behind me the whole time as I was, like, trying to change their schedule and trick them into going on a different thing.
That didn't happen to me, because I'd squirted him with pigeon pheromone.
What?
And he'd been carried away by a flock of pigeons.
Oh, shit. I didn't know there were, like, multiple ways of doing this.
No, I don't think that helps in any way. But when you interact with certain things, you get this kind of, like, little hand on your screen, like a finger, so you can kind of move dials and clocks with this thing. And then when you stop interacting, this hand just falls away, and you realize it's just this kind of cardboard cutout on a lollipop stick.
Like, that's what it looks like from the start, but you just think it's part of the game's art style.
Yeah, exactly.
It's a little bit incongruous.
One of the weirdest bugs, I broke the game because I accidentally embedded some communist cornflakes into a phone. which I don't think I've seen that in any other kind of bug fix notes before. But yeah, the communist cornflakes actually say, "Taste great even in the milk of a capitalist pig." Or worse than the fact. Yeah, just everything, like, just everything deserves to be looked at in that game, and there's always something funny about it.
It reminded me of kind of 30 Flights of Loving, but
it's very
entirely for laughs instead of just...
Yeah, that's probably 30 Flights of Loving with the sensibility of Airplane.
It's interesting because, like, this is a thing that point-and-click adventurers used to do, where you would have to click, because they were badly designed, basically, you would have to click on every object in an environment to work out what you could interact with, and then people started putting jokes in those descriptions, the character remarking upon them in a funny way, and so you got, like, a really high density of jokes in a way that games haven't done since in other genres, that even Portal doesn't have that kind of density in an environment. Whereas this sounds like it does. This sounds like Deus Ex beats Airplane.
Yeah. Yeah, that's not a bad comparison, really.
I think that the thing I like, the refreshing thing about it is that although we're comparing it to all these different things, like, we're having to go to movies to find a point of comparison, because I actually nominated it for the Nuovo Award in the IGF, which is a thing for, like, new and experimental and avant-garde, and often it's, like, really arty, wanky games. But I think this qualifies, because it's, like, I've genuinely never played anything like this. I've never played anything that is a comedy game in this way, in that, like, we're just going to pack jokes into absolutely everything all over the place, the way a Simpsons episode does, or, like, a Futurama episode, you know, where there's way more jokes than you'll ever get, and there's jokes that are going to go over your head, and there's jokes that won't, and there's loads of, like, half the stuff you're talking about I missed when I played it. So just really, like, densely packed. And it feels like it feels like they didn't start with somebody's game as a template and then make it better. It feels like they just didn't have the rule book for what you do in a game. Like, they didn't have the rule book that says, just make generic rooms and put, like, one detailed thing in it, and then the player will see that and move on. They didn't know you're supposed to do that, so they just made everything incredibly rich and detailed.
Yeah, they've taken... The 30 Fights of Loving is a good analog, because they've also borrowed a lot of the kind of, you know, that's very kind of cinematically influenced game, with lots of a lot of the camera angles and things like that are influenced by it. And the same happens in this.
Did anyone play Quadrilateral Cowboy?
Not yet.
You've all gotten access to the cool version that I was talking about.
Awesome. I'd recommend if anyone comes to my IGF judge, don't go down it alphabetically like I've been doing.
680 entries.
I know, I've reached E, which means I've missed so much awesome stuff. Quadrilateral Cowboy is going to take me fucking years to get there.
I won't talk about this build before in a previous Creighton Crowbar, but I will just say one of the thing I didn't do in the build previously, like, I played all the missions, and then the final mission is to do the same mission again, but in 60 seconds, and I was nowhere close to doing it, because it was like, Jesus Christ, that's a lot of typing, because you type out all your commands in a little laptop. And the secret to it, which I knew at the time, is you write out the commands ahead of time, and Chris told me that you can actually create batch files in this game, so on your little hacking laptop, as you're hacking into these buildings, you can not only just write out a set of commands, but save that as a batch file, and then execute that later by typing, I think, execute Riker 1 was the suggested batch file. And so I went back and did this, and there's, I think there's only two objectives in the end. But you've got to get into the building, get into the first objective, get out of there, get into the second objective, get out of there, get all the way back out, and back out of the building. And so I ended up creating, like, a batch file for the first objective and a batch file for the second objective, and then chaining them together, and even figuring out, like, my own syntax for every time I make a batch file, the last instruction in it should be to quit out of the Telnet program and then execute a new batch file, which I haven't created yet. Because if I never do create one, then it just produces an error but doesn't do anything bad. If I do create one later, then I don't have to go back and edit the previous batch file. They'll just naturally link each other in. So I'm, like, future-proofing my own code in this game. And it took a lot, like, I took a bunch of attempts, and I had to keep going back and fine-tuning, the wait command between these two things needs to be, like, 17 seconds, not 15 seconds. And here, after I complete the second objective, I've given myself too generous a time limit to get back up to the skylight, and I need it to be, like, 6 seconds shorter, because I think I can make it. And then when you execute those, the main thing you have to do is disable a bunch of lasers, get to this trunk thing, and then hack your laptop into it, and then get back out again. And the game is super awkward to control. Like, I think it's safe to say, there's commands for getting out your laptop, putting down your laptop, using your laptop, picking up your laptop without using your laptop, executing a command, using your laptop, executing a command, and packing up your laptop in the same motion. And these are all different keys, and it's really hard to remember what you do. And to hack these trunk lines, you have to unscrew two different screws, pull off a panel, then place your laptop on the ground so that a phone line connects with it, and then pick it back up again without using it. But you can't use it. If you use it, then you get sucked into the interface again, and you've got to exit out of that, and that wastes precious seconds. So each time I'm programming this, I have to account for how many seconds it's going to take me to do this before I go back to the laser grid, because as soon as I get back to the laser grid, I want the laser grid to turn off again so I can get through. And so I'm like, how long is it going to take me? Like, if I do it right, it's like 3 seconds. If I do it wrong, it's like 15 seconds. So I'm like, I only give myself 5 seconds. And then when you know, like, you've programmed this, the time limit you're working against is your own time limit. And you've given yourself 5 seconds to get these two screws off, pull the panel down, get the laptop out, hack it into the trunk line, pick it back up again, and then run out. when you're actually doing it, it's so tense and so, like, you get proper, like, performance anxiety. Like, all I've got to do is take out the two screws. I've just got to take out the two screws. Don't miss the screws. Don't fall over. Don't throw your own face into your laptop. Don't, like, tumble back into the lasers. It's so cool.
It sounds amazing. But is this only going to be a game that coders can play? Sounds quite complex, though.
Yeah, it's... It's hard for me to judge because I actually do program things.
Yeah,
now.
Exactly,
like,
yeah.
Actually, in the last few years, I became a programmer pretty much. And I'm a bad programmer and a slow programmer, but this is about at my level. It's like I have no trouble learning the language. I have no trouble typing in the help command and looking up things and writing these really long batch commands. But I do, every time I'm doing it, I'm thinking, this comes fairly naturally to me, but I wouldn't want my mother to play this. But I think there'll be some people for whom it's a big learning curve, and there will be some people, probably not like core gamers, but some people for whom they'll just never be able to play this. Like, it'll just be so much learning of syntax and learning of executing things, that it'll be like beyond their threshold of patience where, you know, you're kind of thinking, yeah, but at the end of this, what am I actually going to get out of it? Because it's going to take me a long fucking time to learn how to do all this.
So like you're ventriloquizing me there, basically.
Anyone who ever used DOS will be fine with this. It's basically DOS, is the operating system.
So you asked at the start of this conversation whether we thought that IGF was worse this year, and I answered the question and no one else did. But you just talked about things that sound amazing in the IGF this year.
I think it's maybe because there aren't any kind of indie colossi in the running. Like Fez was obviously huge, had a lot of kind of head of steam, as did Spelunky when it was...
Well, the Stanley Parable is in, and the Swapper, and
Papers, Please as well.
Octodad. Papers, Please, I think, is bound to win something.
Yeah. Terrible Space Program.
Yeah, that's actually probably the biggest one, isn't it, in terms of...
That's interesting, yeah. I haven't looked at the comments on it. I suppose we probably can't talk about them even if I had, but I don't know how much indie credit it has. It's a massively popular game and hugely, hugely successful. But there's a kind of a difference between a successful game and an IGF winner. Like the stuff that, you know, Cart Life won last year, which is, I don't know, I shouldn't really say anything about whether it's been commercially successful, but in my head, it's not a blockbuster. But it's definitely like, in terms of interest to the indie community, it's, you know, an innovative game and reflects its theme and its mechanics and, you know, accurately conveys a feeling that's interesting and it's very unusual. And I guess, Kerbal Space Program feels like it's quite a sort of technical thing, and I don't know. It'd be interesting to see if it does do well in the IGF in general. I think Papers, Please is kind of a shoe-in for,
for
all the Cart Life reasons.
I think, Kerbal suffers from not having any politics to it. It's just a sandbox that people go in.
Yeah.
It's a toolbox, which is amazing when Minecraft happened. And that
Minecraft won.
So, there's every chance that this will too. And I hope it does, because I think it's an extraordinary... little game that's going to become amazing. Speaking of someone who's only been an IGF judge for this year and last year, I preferred this year to last year's entry. It feels like Christmas to me. Just having all this amazing, interesting stuff to download just for free and judge it is fucking amazing. But I found more interesting stuff this year, stuff like Cryptid the Necro Dancer. Good fun.
Oh yeah, I've been playing that on your recommendation.
Yeah,
it's great.
Yeah, it's really cool. Yeah. Did we talk about it on the podcast before?
I don't think.
Chris did, didn't he? He said he was going to. I can't remember if he did.
The name
because he called it the most Chris Thurston game ever.
I'll just run through what it is quickly in case people don't know what it is. But yeah, Cryptid the Necro Dancer is basically a blend of a roguelike with a rhythm action game or a kind of dance game where there's a constant beat, a pulse that's happening all the time. And you can only move on every pulse of the music. And it's kind of riffs on old school roguelikes, which were turn-based. So you'd make a turn and the monsters would make a turn and you'd all the monsters would move a block and you'd move a block. Except this is every second or every half a second. And you're fighting by running into enemies. But the beat and the music changes from level to level and becomes faster and faster. So the beats per minute goes up, which means the decision making you're having to do from level to level has to get faster and faster. So actually it's a difficulty curve. But if you chain together moves on the beat correctly, the squares, is all grid based. Turn into a dance floor and you start getting neon kind of flashing pulse lights coming through the dungeon floor as you're fighting monsters. And that creates a multiplier that lets you get more gold from monsters. So if you have like a maximum musical chain, you're going to get more gold from the things that you kill. And it turns into this fantastic, really clever mechanical mix of like rhythm-based action and old-fashioned roguelike mechanics. Really, really, really cool.
And you can put your own music into it as well.
Yes.
Oh, really?
Which is quite a lengthy process at this point with the kind of beta version to run it through the sequencer or whatever it is that works out that. But I did it using the VVV soundtrack.
Oh, cool.
So I'm playing it with that, which is just brilliant.
Super Hexagons might be good.
Oh, that's a good one, yeah. Exactly that kind of thing. Any sort of like house music or anything that's got a really firm beat to it, it will work amazingly well with it. And I think it helps at the moment if you have music that's the same beats per minute for each level and you're kind of putting them in because it is, because pre-made and you don't have to slow them down or anything. Yeah, that's really cool.
I've been playing 868 Hack, which is a Michael Brow game. I think Brow, is that the right pronunciation?
Some people say Bro.
Bro.
I think maybe Bro.
Michael Bro. And it's interesting to me because I've played a bunch of his games. Well, I definitely played, off the top of my head, I can think of Crypt and Vector, as Vertex Dispenser, both of which are very highly praised and both of which I didn't get on with because I found both awkward to play in completely different ways. Vertex Dispenser is one where you have to solve an incredibly complex vertex colouring maths problem whilst under attack from arcade-style enemies. I was fighting off things on this 3D shape. And it's really interesting, a really cool idea, but I found it just incredibly stressful to play. And then Crypt is a crate-pushing... Well, initially, it's a crate-pushing puzzle game in which the crates stick to you and you can't get them off you unless you, like, scrape them off against a wall. And I found that incredibly annoying. Like, it's an intellectually interesting puzzle mechanic, but I found it, like, super, like, irritating to play. It's, like, being covered in Velcro whilst playing a crate puzzle. And the crate puzzles aren't that interesting, aren't that much fun in the first place, in a tactile way. And there's... The reason people like Crypt is to do with what happens in the second phase of the game, which I won't talk about. But I didn't even get that far because I just found the puzzles too difficult and also annoying on a different level. So I was worried that maybe I just didn't kind of get this guy's games. I sort of respect him enormously because they're clearly very clever games, but they always seem to have something in them that was irritating to me or off-putting. And 868 Hat is the first one of his that I just outright love. It's just awesome. And it's a roguelike, technically. It's a randomized game where you are a sort of abstract avatar in a hacking system. So you're just a little smiley face on a grid. And also on that grid are walls, which are just solid tiles, and enemies, which are like, there's virus enemies and glitch enemies and demon enemies. And they're all different, like, computer programs, basically. And you kind of harvest resources from this world by deploying, the like little bombs that basically all of the adjacent tiles, you get all of the resources on them. And if you, like, just on the floor, there'll be, like, dollars and energy points. And there'll be, like, in that tile, you can see you're going to get 3 energy points from that tile and $2 from that. And then you can find really good places to plant them where you'll get loads of resources. But if your bombs, I can't remember what they're called, siphons? Yeah, siphons. If they hit a wall, every wall has in it a program that you can get that will, like, a new ability for you to use. And they also summon a certain number of enemies. So on them they have, like, a number and a program. So it will say, like, wait and 2. And wait is a program that lets you just stay on the same tile. Usually in roguelikes, when you move, everything else moves with you. Sometimes you want everyone else to move without you moving. So wait's, like, the simplest program and the most basic and one of the cheapest to use. But if you take that tile, then an enemy's going to come. And if there's 7 on it, then 7 enemies are going to spawn. And the enemies are persistent between levels, so even if you get out of that level, the 7 enemies you just summoned will follow you with you, and all the enemies on the next level will come in as well. And combat is basically like roguelikes in that if you move towards an enemy, you attack them, but you have infinite range. So if you move in the direction of any enemy, instead of moving, you fire a laser at them, which means, like, in theory, you can't move towards an enemy because you always attack them instead. But that's okay because your laser kind of stuns them, so they won't move towards you either, and they can't attack at range ever, so you're kind of safe. And so it's all a strategy of, like, okay, if there's just one enemy, you can always defeat them because you can always just move in their direction and you will keep hitting them and stunning them and they'll never get any further towards you. If you're surrounded, though, if there's 2 enemies next to you, you're going to attack one and the other one's going to hurt you. And so all the programs are things like, one might destroy everything on your row. So if you use that and then you attack the one that was in your column, then you're safe because you've dealt with both of them. So it's all like, it feels like a puzzle game in terms of like it's very hard and fast rules, and you get into a situation where there might only be one way out, or there might be, you have to really think about how you're going to get out of the situation. But because it's randomized, there's a decent chance that you might just be screwed. Yeah. Or there's a decent chance it might be quite easy. It might be that there's, you know, six different ways out of this, depending on the programs you found and how you played. And at first, I felt like I was getting screwed all the time. I'd just get into the next level, and I'm like, oh shit, there's like 17 enemies here, and there's no way out of that situation. Like, no matter how smart you are, you're never going to get around having all these enemies attacking you from all these directions at once. But once you realize enemies carry over between levels, then you can be really cautious about it. Like, enemies don't spawn very fast, just as if you don't do anything. If you just walk around the map and don't activate anything, then they'll only spawn once every few turns, and you can easily deal with them one at a time. And so it's up to you how much aggro you want to incite, and so it's up to you how much, how many programs you want to get, and how many resources you want to accumulate, and some of the walls, instead of having a program, they'll just have points. Points do absolutely nothing. They just show score at the end of the game. And so early on, you don't bother with them at all. There's no you just want to see if you can complete the 8 levels and get to the finish. And all of the things that you capture should be programs that improve your abilities and actually make it more likely you'll get through later levels. But then once you get good enough to always get through the 8 levels, then you want to kind of take on a bit more risk and get some score so that you just see how well you do, basically. So it's really smart in that you kind of, it's a randomized puzzle game, sort of dynamically generates puzzles from your random situation and the programs you've chosen to capture and consequences of your choices through all of the levels you play. But one where you get to kind of choose your own level of difficulty, and you can, if you like, just try and get through the levels and play it quite easy. Huh. And so I've got to the stage now, first time I've ever felt this with a Michael Brau game, where I feel fine. If I want to, I can get through all 8 levels pretty reliably and just kind of have fun and enjoy, like, being able to defeat the challenge and always having a solution and always having, like, ah, okay, I'm surrounded, but I've got this cool program that can wipe out that row, and I know how to deal with this type of enemy. Then, like, only when I'm completely comfortable with that will I decide, and now I'm going to take that tile, which gets me 7 points and summons 7 enemies, and it's going to make it way harder for a while, but I'll, you know, figure out a way to deal with it. Yeah, it's really cool.
I love games in which you can choose your own difficulty level as play through the decisions you're making, and that's so rare. Vertex Dispenser was great, though. And I agree with your criticism of it, but the puzzle mechanic was so clever, so much so that years after playing it, I can't quite remember how to describe it. It was something to do with color coding,
on a set of mathematical problems, which are some of the most mathematically interesting problems we face today. Like, so the biggest number ever to be proven to have any mathematical value, to be of any interest, you know, obviously there's infinity, but the biggest finite number, like the largest number that's ever been used in a mathematical sum that's has any purpose, is this absurd thing that you could never write down given, you know, before the heat death of the universe. But its use is in coloring vertexes on a n-sided polyhedron. And all these problems, they're super complex. That's why the game's so fucking hard. Because we're dealing with literally some of the most complex problems in mathematics. But they're all about, like, let's say you have a dice, which is just a cube, and each corner has to have a different color. And, let's say you have, like, 4 colors. How do you color the corners so that no 2 adjacent vertices are the same color? So you can't have a red and a red where you can draw a direct line between them.
Hmm.
And with a cube, it's fairly simple, but with a kind of much more complex shape, it gets more intricate. And the problem of how many colors do you need to color this without any of them being the same next to each other is incredibly complex. And that's basically what you have to do in Vertex Dispenser whilst being attacked.
You do it to claim territory on the insided polyhedron while other ships are also moving along vertices doing the same thing. But I think based on the colors you're using to color in, does that unlock different powers?
Yeah, so it's kind of, they're almost like different flavors of energy or mana. And the way it uses the coloring mechanic is things always go to the easiest color they can. So if you capture your first node and it's blue, capture the next one, it can't be blue, so it has to be red. And then if you capture the one next to the red one, it'll go blue. So it wants to go to the easiest, cheapest type of color. But you want it to go to the most valuable color, so you try and surround something with blue so that it can't go blue, it has to go red, and then you surround it with red and blue, and it has to go pink or something. And then those later types, the like green and violet and mauve and stuff, power your most powerful abilities. And so you're like, shit, I need a mauve node. And the only way I can get it is if that node is also surrounded by a red, a green, a blue, a pink, and a purple.
See, if they had taught me maths with attack ships and mauve nodes, I would not have a useless English literature degree right now. I would be a scientist.
It's only good for words!
I the reason it sticks in my memory is I interviewed Michael Bruff.
That wasn't one of your questions then.
No. I wish it was, actually. But the thing was that Vertex of Spencer came out and he worked on it for a long time because it's his most graphically complex game. It's 3D and the puzzles are complex enough that I think it took him a long time to balance it or whatever else and write AI competitors that were trying to do the same thing as you were and that kind of thing. But basically he talked in the interview about how it just destroyed him, like in terms of the fact that he put so much energy into this game and then it came out and it wasn't successful. Mm. And talking about your kind of creative energy as a resource as important or more important than money or anything else when you're an indie designer, because if you put all of your eggs in this one basket and it doesn't succeed, it can be enormously discouraging. And it's been actually really great to see that he's made these games like Crypt and 868 Hack and so on, and I think Glitch Tank as well is him, which don't at all betray the values that he was trying to communicate or was communicating with Vertex Dispenser in terms of the types of puzzles he enjoyed, but which have been, if not hugely commercially successful, embraced by a community, by more than just the indie scene, essentially. Like, there are players that love those games, and it's been really great seeing him find an audience, because he's super smart as a designer.
Yeah. Now he's got me.
What have you been playing this week, Graham?
I've been playing SimCity Cities of Tomorrow.
That's a terrible title.
Yeah. Don't, if your game has city in it, use the word city or the plural of city again in the subtitle.
Thinking of it as the Futurama guy saying it, cities of tomorrow! That kind of thing.
Yeah. It's the first proper expansion pack for SimCity, which only came out in March, would you believe? It feels
really?
Like it was last year, but no, it was March of this year. Really? And if listeners don't know, it caused a total shit show on the internet, because the city sizes were quite small, because the simulation was limited and broken, because it required an always online internet connection, and the servers had hour-long queues and kept falling over and breaking, and they had to turn off a bunch of features in order to get it to run properly at launch, and it was disastrous, basically. It was disastrous in all the ways that everyone everywhere predicted it would be. Which was fun. But despite all of those things, and despite all the ill feeling towards it, I really enjoyed playing it, despite the ways it was broken, and it was broken. Like, you would get to a point in your city where it wouldn't grow anymore because people in their houses couldn't find the shops that were directly across the road from them.
Yeah.
Like, the pathfinding on roads was just awful, and there were all kinds of little holes in that simulation. Yeah. And they've released 8 patches since then. And they didn't go for version numbers. There were just patch 1, patch 2, patch 3, and they really sold the notion that these were making big sweeping changes, and to some degree they were. And they have fixed a lot of the problems, but not all of the problems. Because I think that there are just intractable problems with trying to simulate an entire city, and I think it's telling. And no one really seemed to acknowledge this, but SimCity's traffic problems. Mm. SimCity 4 had the exact same problems and the same bugs and the same criticisms, which is why its first expansion pack was called Rush Hour and was designed purely to fix the traffic system. And Cities of Tomorrow, although it's ostensibly future themed and it's about building these kind of mega towers and that kind of thing, I think is sort of a brute force way to get around those intractable problems of SimCity as a general concept and this new engine in particular. For example, people complained about the city sizes and not having enough landmass, and that meant that there was a kind of cap on how much population or resource your city could really create. Well, now they've added mega towers, and one of your little citizens comes out to tell you about them and says, build up, not out. And it's like the developer is pleading with you.
The engine can do lovely. Yeah.
Build up. See, it's bigger
his
now.
Name, Max Is.
And all of the additions that the game makes are like that. So it's all future themed, and there are two sides of that. One of which is that you can now build. So delivered via city specializations, like before you used to be able to do tourism or culture or gambling or whatever. Now you've got three new specializations, one of which is the Academy, which is a building that you can plop down, and then that allows you to research new technologies like wave generators, which doubles your power output and that kind of thing, and lets you use the ocean for that stuff. Skyways, which allow you to link the mega towers that you build and that kind of thing. There's Omega Co, which is essentially the kind of evil future corporation, which produces a resource called Omega, which is never described, but apparently everyone loves. And what it does, is when you place it down, it starts to ship it to all the factories around it, and then after a certain point, those factories become franchises of Omega Co. But then you can start to produce drones, and civilians will... Residents in your city will buy drones, and then their houses and shops will become also franchises of Omega Co. So basically you turn your whole city into this, like a zombie infestation. And it's kind of a neat way essentially to give an aesthetic overhaul to your city by deciding I want it to look like Blade Runner. And because Omega Co, when you become a franchise of that, you're building gets painted black and neon signs get pasted all over the outside of it. If you go down the Academy route, then you can build a city which looks like a piece of concept art for a smart city. You know, it's all white buildings and mega towers. You can build either type, elite mega towers, which are really pretty, or the Blade Runner style, and they kind of park levels and stuff like that. So you can watch people hanging about amongst the trees a mile high in the sky and stuff. And that's all really cool. So it's really pretty. But really it feels like, so those drones that Omega Co. put out, your residents will buy them and they'll use them to go shopping rather than leaving the house. And the mega towers, you have kind of resident levels, but then you add a mall level and an office level. And it's basically, it's all stuff which is designed such that residents never have to leave their houses or drive anywhere. And the drones still travel along the roads, but they don't get stuck in traffic. They don't stop for traffic lights or anything because they can fly.
Yeah.
And so basically the traffic problems that were there, they fixed them up to a certain point, but not that much.
Yeah,
okay. And so the way to get around it is to introduce a bunch of magical vehicles which don't have the limitations of having to stop at red lights or queue at traffic. So even though the pathfinding problems are still happening, you don't notice them as much.
It's just bypass them. It's kind of weird. Like, they must have surely known that the traffic thing was the problem, because if you zoom in and watch a fire station, sometimes traffic jams are so bad can form that the fire engines can't leave the fire station and put out fires. Like, they could have just had a standard animation on roads that was just traffic, and then the actual information, the actual game logic would say, look, the citizen takes 90 seconds to get from here to there, but it doesn't have to actually be a car, you know. But a bit more smoke and mirrors would work better in this scenario than what they tried to do. They were always too ambitious with
it. I think that's exactly right. I think that's why people were so angry about it in a way that they weren't with previous games. And SimCity 4 had a similar thing where it wasn't to the same degree where one car equaled one resident and was an agent in the world, but it did animate cars. You could see individual people, and it was a little bit of smoke and mirrors, but it was there, and you could see the mistakes. Previous games, I'm not sure if SimCity 3000 did it, but certainly 2000 in the first one just had a street with like an animated traffic texture on top of it, and it was completely abstract, just conveying a stat, basically. And so there was never any sense of, oh, hang on a second, no one's using my highways, because they always look for the shortest route and not the fastest route. And so they don't take the three-lane highway over there. They take the small little dirt road, which has 3,000 other cars on it at the moment, because they think they don't notice that there's all those other cars. I really like the expansion from an aesthetic point of view. It looks beautiful, and that was kind of the charm of the base game as well, was just, even though it's broken, if you really zoom in and think about what's happening, it's just a brilliant ant farm. Like, there's just stuff happening all around, and it's, if you don't look too closely, it does sell the kind of fantasy of that that game in a way that the previous ones don't, I think. And the new buildings and stuff like that look great. There's more to the kind of the weird metaphor with the developer as well. Like, for example, the Academy broadcasts a thing called ControlNet. And ControlNet doesn't travel along the roads, because again, they don't want to add anything that does that, I suppose. It just travels through the air, so it's Wi-Fi. And it's powered by different wealths of residents. So not how educated they are, but how wealthy they are, and rich people are the best. And that's the thing which then powers all your futuristic tech in the city. So if you've got a maglev, like an elevated railway running on magnetic tracks, it's powered by a control net wirelessly, and it's powered by rich people. It feels like a metaphor for always online internet connection in a really awkward way that surely is not intentional.
Yeah.
But I love the aesthetics of the city, and it's great to look at. And it is a kind of neat brute force way of overcoming some of the limitations that were there in the base game.
Hmm.
The problems I have with it is that people on one floor of your mega tower will not be able to find the shops on the floor above them sometimes. They still complain about... There are still...
an elevator jam.
New traffic problems above the actual traffic problems.
I don't know whether it's bugs or if it's just there's not enough clarity in why something has gone wrong. But like, yeah, in a city I've got at the moment, I've got a recycling centre which is set up to take all the city's recycling and then produce different products out of it, different materials, so like plastics and that kind of thing, which I can then sell on the market, and that makes my city a lot of money.
Hmm.
I can look at that building and I can see that it's got recycling trucks, and I've placed the little huts so it's got them in the garages. I can look at my city and see that there is 28,000 pieces of recyclable materials sat outside people's houses, and I can look at the number that says that my center has collected zero of that 28,000 and so isn't doing anything with it. Hmm. And I have no idea why.
Yeah.
I don't know if that's a bug, don't know if that's something I've done wrong, don't know why, just there's no way for me to know. And that was always the case, where it just doesn't work, and that's still the case now. The other problem I have with it is that it's £25, and if you've got...
Well, just the expansion.
The expansion is £25, yeah, $30 or £25 on Origin.
Those are the same.
Yeah, that also doesn't make sense.
Yeah.
But there's quite a lot of content there, and they've done like lots of future versions of existing buildings and lots of new buildings and stuff. But if you have an existing city, which is already successful, you can pretty much instantly afford to buy all this stuff and start researching it and powering through it. So you can have seen most of the really big additions within an hour. Mm-hmm. And then after researching some stuff, after 5 hours, you'll have seen most of the other things which you're really interested in.
Yeah.
Starting a new city from scratch, it would take you about 10 hours maybe. But for £25, mm-hmm. it's a bit... especially when it still doesn't quite work.
Imagine if on your train powered by rich people, the guy from Risk of Rain got on there with his gold bomb that fell.
I mean, I guess why people play city building games for different reasons. There are the kind of min-maxing people who want to create the most efficient system. There's the guy who created the terrifying SimCity 2000, I think it was.
Oh, yes.
Metropolis, yeah, yeah. He just filled those maps were huge, and he would fill them from corner to corner with patterns of buildings in order to create the most powerful economy he could.
It's amazing. I think it's soundtrack. The video is soundtrack with Carmina Burana or some kind of apocalyptic sounding classical music.
He posted
Latin eight quotes appearing.
He posted scans of like supposedly his notebooks where he'd worked out all the maths of this, and it was like,
but they were written in
like,
blood.
It was like it was written by John Doe from Civit or something like that. Like. That was amazing, but you can't do that in the new
city. No,
that doesn't support
it's lost
those
that.
People.
Exactly, and I think those people are the people who buy expansion packs to have mechanical changes. But this isn't The Sims, where there's a strong fashion element that people are buying into constantly with new expansion packs. Like making buildings look pretty, the fashion of a city isn't what people, the hardcore city building people want. They want interesting new mechanics to play with and interesting new ways to make more efficient cities or more efficient.
I guess they're banking on the fact that the remaining players that they have are the people who are just going to suck it up and pay 25 quid for this. Because everybody else would have just been sick of it by now, and you know they're not going to get people back, are they?
I don't know. Like, I read a lot of blogs about futuristic cities and stuff, and I'm quite interested in smart cities and that kind of thing, but there's nothing conceptually about the ideas that this game's introduced, which are that interesting in and of themselves, and mechanically there's nothing that the game adds which is distinct from the stuff you were already doing. So it introduces a new resource in Omega, but it's built by getting oil and ore together, which were resources that already existed in the game. So your considerations there are the same. And with Control Net, it's attracting different educated workers to go to that building to power that. And so, like, from a mechanical point of view, you're not thinking about anything new. And that really bothers me about it.
Yeah.
And that does imply that, you know, okay, they're not really going for those min-maxing people. They're not really concerned with mechanics. They're more concerned with aesthetics. Mm. But within that, the aesthetics that I care about, I quite like vanilla city building games. Like, there's the Anno series and that sort of stuff, which are historical, and then there's all these different games like SimCity Societies, for example, which try to push you into making cities of a particular type. But the reason I always liked the SimCity games was that you just were building a city. And I like cities. I want to build a city, and within that have a sense of neighborhoods, maybe. And aesthetics can help with that if you've got a neighborhood which is, oh, you know, 1950s craftsmen's houses next to one which is kind of brownstones and stuff like that. You can do that sort of stuff. And SimCity doesn't really support that in a way which I find disappointing. And this being a kind of futuristic flight of fancy bothers me as well. I'd much prefer it was more set in a modern day reality,
like,
or more about more about introducing different types of buildings. Like the DLC packs that they sold at launch were for French buildings, British buildings in another country, I think. But basically it was hey, you can have the Eiffel Tower, that sort of stuff. Mm. When actually I don't want that. What I want is houses which don't look like they're from the American South. I want houses that also look like they're from Brooklyn, and houses that look like they're also from Bath, and, you know, I want different types of stone. that's what I want in my expansion. Limestone.
Architects, you want to get an architect DLC who just comes in like Christopher Wren at some point and builds a whole load of buildings for you.
It's interesting to contrast this with something like XCOM Enemy Within, which is a fantastic expansion for Enemy Unknown, in that it adds new stuff, but it encourages new ways of approaching the same content, like new strategies and new ways of thinking about it entirely, and new ways to specialise, and that, like, it's got to renew the initial game. An expansion has to renew it almost completely for you, for, you know, it's got to be more than just the visuals of the thing. It's got to turn it on its head in some way.
Which this isn't. I mean, it's not even an end game. Like, you can, like, because you've already got existing cities, which it applies to, and you can do that really quickly, or even starting from afresh, which is what I did to start with. You just get there really fast. Mm. It's really odd.
Makes me sad. Because, like you, I enjoyed it for 2 weeks before kind of being overwhelmed by its flaws.
But did you find at that point that you hated it? Like, because that's the thing that seemed to happen, is that there were just a bunch of people who would just be fucking furious about this fucking game and how shit it was. And you say, well, how long did you play it for? 40 hours!
Yeah, exactly.
Well, okay. Maybe you were really pissed off for the last 5. But surely you must have enjoyed the lion's share of that experience. Otherwise, what the fuck were you just doing?
Yeah. I found it extremely frustrating, having played it at a preview event, where I played for, like, 3 or 4 hours with all of the features turned on that they had to turn off because of the always online fast that happened.
Yeah.
And that included cheetah mode, which was the fastest speed at which your city could grow. And that, like, without that, there was a lot more, it was so much more boring just to have to watch your city grow. Like, there's a reason they put that mode in there in the first place.
It's back now.
Oh, good.
Not one of the patches has added it back. So.
That was a big problem for me. Yeah.
Yeah. I still enjoyed playing it. Don't buy it. It's too expensive. I still had fun for 10 hours.
Shall we do questions?
Yes.
From questions.
Best place for them. We have one from Nate Behrens, I'm gonna guess that's how you pronounce it. The questions this time, thanks to Tom, are printed very, very small, so I apologise if I make any mistakes in reading them. But Nate says, "Hi, Creighton Cro-Magnon. Half-Life is 15 years old today, and in a bit of a wistful remembrance, I recall my first time playing the game. I had to play in software mode, as I didn't have a graphics card." Remember when we didn't have graphics cards? That's a weird idea. And the only resolution that could manage a playable frame rate was 320 by 240. Jesus. But even so, I'm pretty sure that my jaw was literally hanging open throughout the entire tram ride. I had never seen a game take the time to immerse the player in a world so fully, and after the first couple of hours of the game, I felt like my entire conception of what games could be had been massively expanded. Before, they were defined by getting stuff, and getting points, and beating the boss, but Half-Life placed me in a world and gave me an experience, an idea that was now ubiquitous, but at the time felt utterly revolutionary to my Doom and Sonic the Hedgehog-addled mind. There have been other moments like that for me over the years, riding through Hyrule Field in Ocarina of Time, my first experience in the other world in Silent Hill, listening to hokey but earnest monologues on the nature of love and war in Metal Gear Solid. These were console games. Storming Omaha Beach in Medal of Honor, Allied Assault. Yeah, it was tough, but man, did it get its point across. Looking back, though, the opening of Half-Life is by far the most influential moment for me in terms of developing my appreciation of the medium. So my question is this. Can you pinpoint a specific transformational moments for you as a gamer when you realised that gaming could be so much more than you had previously imagined? Bonus question. Half-Life, Zelda 64, Metal Gear Solid, War from 1998, which for my money is by far the best year gaming ever had. StarCraft, Thief, Baldur's Gate, Unreal, Rainbow Six, Pokemon, Tribes, and Grim Fandango? Come on. What do you think is the best year in gaming history?
I have an answer to his...
Thanks for reading, everybody! Love the show.
Sorry, I didn't wait for you to finish written in. Actually, you wrote down, because 2007 is a more recent year, not often... Like, people think of the kind of golden age of video games, they always kind of delve much further into the past. But 2007, Supreme Commander came out that year, Crackdown, Peggle, Stalker, Bioshock, Skate, which is, you know, okay. Halo 3, The Orange Box, Super Mario Holy Galaxy, shit. Crisis, Uncharted, and Assassin's Creed.
Holy shit.
That was a pretty good year, I think.
Orange Box and Bioshock alone.
Consoles came out that year as well.
So. That's Portal, Team Fortress
2. I remember seeing Supreme Commander, Bioshock, and Spore at the same E3 in 2005. And forget what you think about Spore as it came out, you know, the final product, but the before release, Spore was, you know, one of the biggest things in the universe.
Oh, yes.
I've seen a game or anything like it. It was mind-blowing. And all the previous stuff we saw beforehand was, or almost all of it, was lived up to that. And so did fucking hell. Supreme Commander, you've seen the trailer for Supreme Commander.
Yeah, well,
even better than the game, and the game is incredibly good. And Bioshock is also a game that shows really well, like when you first see that running, and you see someone playing it, and they see them messing around with the Big Daddy and stuff, and the atmosphere was just absolutely phenomenal. So seeing those three games came away just completely like, holy shit, like, games next few years of games are going to be incredible.
Yeah, just, I think there was just such a sense within the game journalism anyway that the medium had arrived that year. You know, it was almost kind of like messianic. Like, games will save us kind of feeling.
So Half-Life 2 Episode 2 was incredibly good, but probably not unprecedented in that it was like Episode 1 and happened, Half-Life 2 had happened, and they're both really good in their own way.
Oh, but that was Portal as well, the Orange Box.
Yeah, and so... And like, just to, Portal, yeah. Exactly, that was what I was going to say.
sorry, Tom.
the amazing thing about the Orange Box was that, like, there had never been anything like Portal before. There had been Back to the Drop, but there had never been anything like Portal in terms of what it actually... What ended up being good about that game was not just the puzzles, but the whole... You know, the writing and how it all hung together so well, and how it's just so perfectly formed and structured and just was a perfect whole. And Team Fortress 2 is also, you know, still playing it to this day. It's just, like, it's evolved like no other game, and it's just been completely revolutionary.
Yeah, in terms of gaming moments that changed the way I felt about games, I'd probably pick the predecessor to Portal, which was, or at least in my mind, which was with the first Unreal game, which allowed you to have things that were called portals in the engine, which linked discrete areas of space together. And there was like a map made for the first Unreal game called DM Escher, I believe, which did exactly that. So it was like walking through like an Escher drawing, because you would walk up this infinite flight of stairs and it would loop back on itself seamlessly and and things like that, because it was able to kind of create these portals between spaces. And that actually blew my mind. So I wasn't terribly impressed by Portal, with it? Obviously Portal is a fucking amazing game, and it uses that far more effectively than Unreal did. But just simply in terms of that technology of linking spaces together, that already blew my mind. And Unreal also, the opening sequence to Unreal, where you emerge from a crashed spaceship into this kind of, what I imagined at the time was like this beautiful lush jungle environment, and it's actually like actually like 20 polygons. that blew my mind. And the Half-Life tram sequence certainly astounded me. I got people around my house to watch that.
Speaking of Unreal and portals, there's an incredible Unreal 2004 map by Angel Mapper Rachel Cordone. I can't remember its title, but we'll put it in the show notes because I'll look it up. But you can search for Angel Mapper, and all of her stuff is on that one site. And it's a beach-type area. It's a multiplayer map, a capture-the-flag map. And your flag is there. There's this beach, there's cliffs, and inside the cliffs is a cave. And in the middle of the cave, there's a portal. And you go through the portal, and you arrive in the same cave. And you go out of the cave, and it's the same beach, but it's at night. And the enemy flag is there. And so the two flags are at different times of day in the same place. And whichever space you're in, you can see the people in the other time of day as ghosts.
Wow!
So you see like transparent things running around, and so you can actually get a strategic map of the enemy base by just looking around yourself and saying, hey, there's white blobs, you know, they're guarding the flag really tightly right now. And obviously it's just two different spaces in the map, and they've just, you know, lit them differently. But the way it feels is like you're actually traveling through time to get the enemy flag. And it's incredible.
That's cool. I'd weirdly pick Final Fantasy VII, which is a strange, batty game story-wise. But at the time I played it, when I was 15, it was my first introduction to Japanese urban aesthetic, like the sort of landscapes you'd see in Blade Runner and Akira and that kind of thing. In the opening city of Midgard, which is this kind of raw, horrible industrial city made of pipes and billowing gas from every possible kind of grates everywhere, and everyone's living a really shit life in like corners. I'd never seen any world like that before, and that was the moment when I kind of encountered games as vehicles for different worlds and different places that you could kind of slot into. And I found that world more convincing than any film I'd seen up to that point, or any television series, or any cartoon, or any comic I'd read. Like, Final Fantasy VII's Midgard was a more convincing place to me, as a place I could explore and poke around inside people's houses, than any other medium that really communicated. And that always stuck with me, I think.
It's a slightly disappointing answer, but Half-Life is my answer.
I've got an idea.
It's not original by any stretch, given the question, but that I would not be doing this job if it was not for that game. I played it when it came out, when I was 13. Didn't like it very much. Went back to it.
I didn't like it at first either.
Went back to it 6 months. I think we talked about this in a previous podcast. Went back to it like 6 months later and fell in love and became utterly obsessed with that game. Obsessed for like the next 5 years. It wasn't like a brief, I played it until completion and then maybe I played it again. No, I started writing for fan sites, and then I started my own fan site, and I started writing for the official Valve editing website, and then I started doing level design for it. Like, at one point I found, while on holiday in England, and I looked at Poxy Little Tourist Shop by the Till, found a CD with a self-printed label which had just Half-Life maps and Half-Life mods on it. It's completely unlicensed, completely illegal. But this game permeated my life in a way that I had not encountered before, and I started just downloading every custom level I could find from File Planet, GameSpy's website, because that's when it was, and I wrote for Planet Half-Life, and my fan site was hosted by Planet Half-Life. Started interviewing modders and level designers and teaching myself how to do that and working on mods, and basically would not have got that job at PC Gamer 8 years ago if I hadn't started playing Half-Life 15 years ago. Mm. And so much of the number of people I know now in games development and people I'm still friends with, and recently, in the news was a Minecraft mod called QCraft.
Yes,
which is kind of like back
mechanics.
Yeah, it's a mod that aims to teach people quantum mechanics, and it's made in partnership with Google, and I was reading about that, and the lead programmer on it is a Minecraft modder called Dan200, and it's now his day job is making QCraft. He's paid to do it. but that turned out to be, when I saw that name, Dan 200, I was like, because it's a mapper from the Half-Life community when I was 14 years old. So I messaged him because he's on my Steam friends list. And yeah, it just completely changed my life and is still a part of my life now because of the number of friends I've made through that community. And although the game has been completely demystified because I learned how it was made and I looked at its code and I learned how to make levels for it and that kind of thing, it still holds a place in my life which no other game can match.
It's all downhill from here.
Yeah. The other thing I would say is, like, I agree with you. Like, I looked up on Wikipedia, basically, for, like, years of game releases to answer the bonus question, and I agree with you that 2007...
I didn't just look up on Wikipedia. I knew already that 2007 was a great year. Well, then I looked up.
I knew that 2007 was a great year, and I kind of looked to see if there were any other years. But personally, 2010 was a great year for me, because that was the year that I played... It wasn't the year they were released, but it was the year that I played Minecraft, Dwarf Fortress, Spelunky, and Worm Online for the first time. And I think all four of those games as a whole recalibrated my brain about, if not what games could be, what I cared about in games, and made me think about them in a new way. Yeah. So that was a good year.
My thing, very briefly, is Ultimate Underworld was the first game I played where I started to see games as a place that worlds could exist rather than just a thing where you get a high score and you kill all the enemies. Because, you know, you're locked. The plot is you are falsely accused of kidnapping a princess or some shit. And you're put in a dungeon and you're in a dungeon and you have expectations of what that's going to be. It's going to be a series of, like, rooms and it's just going to be shit. You're like, this is the whole game? This is strange. And you walk along the dungeon for a little while and you hack up some monsters and you get some loot and it's all fairly video gamey. And then I met an orc who didn't attack me. And, or it might be a goblin, I'm actually not actually sure what the taxonomy is, but they, I was able to just talk to them, and then I could trade with them. Well, that's weird, he's got like an inventory, like he owns items, and I own items, and he's like, has a notion of what a fair trade is and stuff, and we can just chat. And then I stopped talking to the orc and moved on, and realised I was in the orc's village, basically, and there was orcs everywhere, and there's a whole tribe of them, and they have their own like religion, and they have campfires, and they have bedrolls, and all of them have individual like sets of possessions. And that, like, elsewhere there's different tribes and there's different religions and there's different cultures down here and they've all been living here for, you know, decades and, they have, like, opinions about each other and they have individual lives and they go about their business. And that was just like, what? No idea you could do that in any way.
See, I think that's a much better game. I almost wish that my thing was Ultimate Underworld or System Shock or that kind of thing, because actually Half-Life's transcendental, oh my god, it's a world! Oh, just tricks. the legacy of those scripted sequences, although they're a very important part of video game storytelling, the legacy of them is Call of Duty. In a way, which is, yeah. On that depressing note.
Jamie Donovan says, "Dear Bottle Grows and Black King Bars, sorry for the Dota joke, everyone who isn't Chris." That's all of us.
One man who could have translated that.
Recently I was unwell for a few days, causing me to fall back on the old tradition of mine when ill, which is to bust out Theme Hospital and cheer myself up. Even after 16 years of playing it on and off, the humour still makes me laugh and the gameplay still holds up really well. It's a real shame that the theme games have seemingly died with Bullfrog. Despite the fact that I've been playing the game for almost 2/3 of my life and consider it myself a competent human being, I still have not completed the game, or even come close to it. It's mostly because I keep uninstalling and reinstalling, but I'm now feeling driven to actually complete the game and kill the metaphorical 16-year-old Moby Dick game, so I can actually know I finished it. So my question is, what game do you guys consider your Moby Dick, i.e. a game that you have been trying to finish for a long time, but for whatever reason cannot do so?
I'd just like to say that it's not his fault that he hasn't finished Theme Hospital, because it is balls hard. Like, it's unfair. Like, it's mechanically unfair.
I didn't realise games like that could be completed.
Yeah, I didn't.
There's a level system, and it gets harder and harder. Like, it's very difficult not to have your character commit suicide while playing Theme Hospital. There's a sequence that can happen where your character, it's quite harrowing for a very funny game, where you just see a picture of your family, and then in the reflection you see a shadow climb up onto a windowsill and then jump off.
Jesus
And then
Christ.
The game ends.
But, like, that happens in Theme Park as well. Like, if your theme park goes bankrupt. But what happens is that at the end of the sequence, I think it's maybe
Like, it's, again, it's like jumping off a balcony. I don't remember if it was in the reflection.
This is a theme park, man! but I mean, a hospital, fair enough.
What happens at the end of that cutscene, though, is that the character lifts himself up, and you see that actually he hasn't jumped off. He's grabbed on, and you just see his like, little head poking up at the top of, like, I guess I'm just dead depressed, but I'm not dead.
Does he say that?
No, but that's the implicit message.
No, that's weird. I don't think it's the writer's fault for not having completed that game. I think it's very difficult and unfair game.
But have you completed it? How do you complete it?
I have not been able to complete it. I think it's just like at higher levels, you just get completely screwed over. But like, I told you guys about the vomit event horizon that can happen in Theme Hospital. The endless, like, the point at which your patients are so ill, they're vomiting to such a rate that you can't hire enough cleaners to ever clean it up, so your entire hospital becomes swamped in vomit. And it's just a cycle that can happen in that game that is just
it's
not
because
balanced.
The patients can vomit if they see vomit.
Yes.
So it becomes so exponentially increasing.
So you can sack all of your doctors and hire nothing but cleaners, and you'll still never, there's a point of no return.
Never wash it up.
That's brilliant.
It's kind of...
As a failure state.
As a failure state, it's hilarious, but there are lots of failure states like that can happen at the hospital that make it very, very difficult to play. Poor guy, if he's been slaving this long to try and beat it.
I don't have a good example of a game that I've played for many years without completing it, because I recently completed Spelunky, don't you know? Until then I did. But I just discovered the other day that I'd never completed Psychonauts, apparently. I was Pendleton Ward, the Adventure Time guy, was playing on a stream, and I tuned in, and I'm like, I've never seen this world before. I guess I must not have finished that game. I thought I had. I love the sort of world design and the writing in Psychonauts, but I fucking hated the actual mechanics of platforming. I got super frustrated with it. So I'm not totally surprised to find that I gave up with it.
Yeah, there's a horrible, horrible level in a kind of circus made up of strung up like bodies and innards and things like that. So you're climbing guts and then you're kind
of... Do you remember circus?
It's the, like the worst level, platforming level I've ever played. Probably.
Maybe that's why I stopped.
It's really, really horrible and difficult. But there's some amazing places. I'd pick Left 4 Dead 1.
You never completed it. Didn't you play that loads?
I did eventually, yeah, but it was a long and spectacular struggle where I lived near my friends for a while and I used to live in Birmingham before I did this job, and we'd all, like, for some weekends, just get all of our PCs into our house into one room, and we'd just play Left 4 Dead, and that was all we'd do. And we'd play it on expert mode. And we'd beat each thing on expert mode without taking a loss, with all of us making it to the end. But then the challenge became to complete all of them in a row from start to finish. So, like, expert, no mercy, right through to the end of the expert, the final mission. That's four campaigns, each of them 90 minutes to 2 hours long. It takes longer if you're on expert mode because tanks take twice as long to kill. Mm. And you're, like, the hordes are just so frequent that you're constantly holding up different places. And, like, we all had, like, a week off. And just massively poop-socked it, to coin an Owen Hill phrase. we just played it in and out, and we came up with strategies, and there was, like, one of us always took the sniper rifle, and he was the guy who would pick off, like, special infected, like, smokers. And then there was two people with shotguns, and there was one with an assault rifle. And we'd had, for every section of each of those maps, we knew where the best hold-up places were, where the best angles were to take on hordes. And because there's a dynamic AI system that's constantly reading your... supposed to read your mood to the AI director, and it throws hordes at you depending on how well or badly you're doing. But even with that dynamic element, we'd find places in those levels to hold up and to exploit.
Your mood is finding the exploit.
Yeah, exactly. And then, yeah, but eventually we did it. And it was, but the journey to doing that and to kind of learning those levels inside out, and it was just fucking amazing. Look, that was one of my favourite gaming experiences ever, I think. Beating hard games can be tremendously rewarding. Same as that and Ikaruga. But that's not a PC game yet. Until next year.
Next question from Daniel. Dear Cr-A-Team and Crowbargonauts. In my younger days, I could happily play through the night if sufficiently immersed in the game without a care in the world. Now I am a decrepit old man with a wife, children, and a job. Poor soul. Game sessions are much shorter. A couple of missions in XCOM, Splunky Day Gallons, Binding of Isaac run. Sprints rather than marathons. So my questions are, outside of reviewing, what has been your longest single play session of any game? Have any types of games you play changed as you got older because of other things in your lives? Really enjoyed the podcast, especially the background tinkle of rum being poured. Adds a lovely ambiance to the proceedings.
Thans for reading, everybody!
Daniel in Leeds. He actually did that phonetically, so Thans for reading, everybody.
It's brandy today, it's not rum. Mm.
Yes.
It's a very nice brandy it is.
I kind of, like, I guess I'm not a decrepit old man with a wife. I'm decrepit, but I don't have a wife, children, or job. but I have lately, I find I play things in like half hour to 1 hour sessions, and I'm also recording them and uploading them as videos, which has a weird effect on the way I play in that, like, I haven't got round to uploading all the things I've played yet, so I have a bunch of videos I haven't uploaded yet that I have I've played. And then I'm now watching them back before I upload them to kind of cut out boring parts, because sometimes, like, Assassin's Creed 4 is the main one I'm kind of uploading at the moment, and sometimes I do stupid things in that that take a long time, so I cut those bits out. But the experience of playing games in, like, half-hour to one-hour chunks, and then also having that as a recorded thing that you then watch back and maybe edit and share with people, and then other people comment on it, and you kind of you tell people about it and you show it to other people, is really weird for me, because I'm terribly unobservant and unattentive. I don't know what the hell the plot of any game I'm playing is. I don't pay any attention to what anyone's saying. I skim past everything. I have no idea what's going on. I usually don't care. But now, because I'm playing in short chunks and then I'm reviewing those chunks as well, I kind of, anything that's cool, I kind of get the pleasure of it twice when I'm watching back. And then, God, that was really awesome. When I took out that ship and I killed those dudes and I kicked that dude off the side, that was awesome. And then also the plot, I suddenly realize, oh, no, I understand that now. I actually didn't understand that at the time, but now I suddenly notice when you're not playing something and you're watching it, you like all the detailed stuff that you miss because you're concentrating, suddenly you see it again. Huh. And so I'm playing in shorter chunks, but I'm kind of appreciating it much more, which is great. But also you start to realize how fucking long games are. Like Assassin's Creed. I'm looking back at my first six or seven parts of that game before I got a fucking ship. Where it's just like, I'm doing assassination contracts in a big city and it's just like all the other Assassin's Creed games. And now that I'm actently into the meat of the game and really enjoying it, I'm looking back at those things. Why the fuck is that there? Why were there 4.5 hours where I don't get to play the actual game and I get to play this other thing that's nothing to do with what's cool about it?
It gives you little hints of what, like, the awesome game to come. Like, the opening of Assassin's Creed 4 is better than the opening of any other Assassin's Creed game because it puts you on a boat in the middle of a thunderstorm, fighting other boats and then eventually shipwreck. But it's incredibly intense and exciting moment that you won't get to do. It's a scripted moment that you could do dynamically all the time later on. And it's like, what are you doing?
Yeah.
Why would you do that? Like, you're not selling the treat of this game is that you could be this boat floating across the ocean getting into these fights whenever you choose to, or going into these storms.
You can be the boat.
To happen. You can be the boat. You can upgrade the boat.
Actually, the best example of that in all of gaming is also from Assassin's Creed. Assassin's Creed 2, which I reviewed. And I got super frustrated, like, very early on. There's, well, not that early on, like, 3 fucking hours in, which is early on in an Assassin's Creed game. You have to chase someone in a cutscene steals something from you, and then you have to chase them to get it back. And if they go too far away, you fail the mission. If you get too close, it's like rubber banded, so they go faster the closer you are to them, and like, it's all completely artificial and fake. And if you, you know, fall off a building once, then it fails the mission. If you get, like, alert a guard, it fails the mission, and all these irritating fail states, and it was one of my most aggravating moments. I hated it, but it was so stupid and it's so scripted and awful. And I finally completed it and caught up with the dude, and he, I don't know, some stupid cutscene where you fail your objective anyway. And it's complete bullshit. And you move on with the plot, and then in the open world, what that mission really was doing was introducing you to the idea that there are people running around the city who you can catch up to and then steal from. So they've like stolen from somebody else and they've got the purse of money, and then you catch up to them and you can steal that purse. And from then on, just around the city as you're roaming around, there will dynamically be people who are running away from a scene of a crime and they have some money and you can chase them down and you can catch them. And just because it's happening in the open world and it doesn't matter if you don't catch them, but you can catch them, it's the best moment in the whole game. It's fucking awesome. You just see someone sprinting across some rooftops or something and you think, shit, that's a thief. I'm going to scramble up this building. I'm going to jump over here. I'm going to dodge that guard. I'm going to have this awesome cinematic moment. I'm going to, like, have this brilliant experience. And then, like, if I do succeed, then I get this fantastic moment when I finally catch him and tackle him down. And if I don't succeed, then he gets away and I'm like, oh, shit. And then I carry on with my life. And both eventualities are good. Both eventualities, like, add to my story. It's consistent. My character carries on and I have a good time. But as soon as you make it into a mission where if I don't do what you expect me to do, it fails the mission and I have to restart it, it's the worst thing in the world. And it's so black and white. Like, I can't believe they played their game back and didn't notice that this part of the game is fucking horrible bullshit. And the next part of the game, which is exactly the same, except for the fail states, is fucking brilliant. I can't believe that they didn't notice that.
The same thing in Assassin's Creed 4, the couriers who are just wandering around, and they're just kind of people who are ferrying around, like... There are Spanish and British forces constantly fighting across the islands, and you'll see them fighting dynamically as you roll, you know, roam the seas. That, like, there'll be a Spanish fleet engaging a British fleet. So there are couriers that are bringing money to forts all the time. And as soon as you see one, it's like a little icon appears on your minimap, and they've never done anything to you. But you know, they're a courier, they're an icon now, and suddenly they're a victim. And you can kind of walk up to them, and as soon as you get too close, they realise that you're after them. And then they'll start running away, and they'll just scream, "Pirate! Pirate!" like that. As though they expect people to respond, and no one does. And, and yeah, they're obviously they're as good as free running as you are, for some reason, but just to make it a challenge.
Yeah.
So you'll end up with these ridiculous long distance, you know, chases across the city in which, you, a pirate, chases a man screaming, "Pirate! Pirate! Pirate!" at the top of his voice. Until you tackle him on the top of a rooftop and, punch him to death and then take
There's,
his
a really good video from a series called History Respawned where they look at Assassin's Creed 4.
This is fantastic, actually.
With
a
I think it's a historian hosts it and then he invites a guest historian who's a specialist in the...
He's a trainee historian. He's at University of Texas, studying to be a historian.
Yeah, so the guy he has on is an expert in, I guess, pirate history in the Pirate Republic of Nassau, and he talks about the historical accuracy of Assassin's Creed 4 whilst this guy plays it, so he'll, like, you know...
Surprisingly, it's actually pretty accurate.
Yeah! It's, yeah, loads of...
Apart from ending up as, you know, a Ubisoft beta tester or something.
Yeah. Well, yeah, the crazy thing is that all of the coolest stuff is real, and then all the dumb shit about Templars is fake.
Bollocks, yeah.
So, like, all of the...
like the flintlock pistols.
Characters and the whole thing about setting up a democracy.
Yeah, what the fuck? I did not know
this. And on a pirate ship, if you're on a pirate ship, if you're just some, like, bosun on a pirate ship who, like, some low-level dude, you get a share of every take that they captured, and the captain only gets 2 shares. So he gets more, but only twice as much.
Yeah.
And you can't think of many, like, very, corporate structures in today's world where the CEO only gets twice as much as the lowest level employee.
Yeah, surprisingly egalitarian. I also didn't know that they'd set up their own kind of little society by themselves. I thought that was a contrivance.
Tortuga is the old idea of the pirate haven, but yeah, Nassau was apparently real. Mm. And that's where you spend most of your time for the first 10 hours, like you're meeting proto Blackbeard before he becomes Blackbeard.
Dak Chin.
He starts off the stubble and it gets bigger and as you meet him until, like, there's one point where you return to the island after a bit of a break and he has this big bushy beard and everyone comments on his beard. It's
good. Got that bit yet.
Yeah, it's fun.
What was the question?
We're completely forgotten.
Outside of reviewing, what has been your longest single PlayStation of any game, and have the types of game you play changed as you've become older because other things of your life?
Second one, definitely, yes.
In answer to the first question, I assume Championship Manager for me, I probably played that for 10 hours a day for weeks and weeks at a time. Wow. Because that's just what I would do. I don't really have any single memory of that, but that's because it just expanded to consume all my time. But I did once stay up for 46 hours for a PC Gamer feature.
Oh, yes.
The aim was to stay up for 48 hours. I didn't quite make it. It turns out the idea was that I would stay up for that length of time and I would play games throughout and see if my reflexes changed it, as my reaction times, my actual skill changed. Turns out, no. And I did. Really? I both played online multiplayer games and did, like, online reflex tests and stuff. Made no difference whatsoever. The only thing that changed was that I no longer cared by the end. I lost any sense of motivation.
Yeah.
Because, like, I started at 8 a.m. in the morning, and you do a full day, and then you do a full night, and then you do a full day, and then you've got to do a second full night. And that was the point at which I gave up and I went to bed. And I wrote the feature and that was fine, but I booked off holiday afterwards because I thought I need some time to sleep and recover. But actually what happened was I just got really sick because it turns out that your immune system gets fucked if you just stay up for 2 days straight. And so I just had the worst cold I've ever had in my life.
So don't do that.
And that's why you quit.
I quit 4 years later, still resentful. In answer to the second question and how my game, the games I've played have changed, it's more for me to do with how quick I am to get around to things. Like, there are certain games which I will just play instantly. If they require a certain degree of immersion, I'm probably going to put them off for a little while until I can carve out a block of time to myself. But the other thing is, doing this job changes the way you approach games, and so pretty much I will never play a new game unless I am some way going to make money from that. And so the games I play for myself are actually the games that I've played 1,000 times before, like FIFA and Spelunky.
Ross Meredith asks, "Dear Crate and Crow Barn Owls, I'm a terrible human being."
Welcome to the club. Me too.
"I've been replaying the first Mass Effect with a button bound to speed up the simulation 10 times whilst pressed. A cute trick that lets me zip through the dull bits of the game without actually missing anything interesting. And I love it. Where a full skip option would be a little too blunt, this lets me finally craft my experience and focus on the bits I wanted to see again, to the extent that I started subconsciously reaching for this button in other games. So here's my question. What sanity-saving feature would you love to see in every game you play, for good or ill? Love and hugs, Ross."
That one.
Yeah,
that's a brilliant
feature. Not only do I want to see that, but I also already use that in any game. Like, any Source Engine game, I know the command to speed up the time scale. And so, even in, like, Stanley Parable most recently, there was a bit where I got to a certain ending of that, and Stanley Parable is all about branching paths, and at any given time you can kind of obey or disobey. And I got to one ending, and then I realized, oh, actually, I kind of wanted to see what happens if I disobey that, but I hadn't... You can save, technically, but you have to enable it in options, and I hadn't saved for a while. So I went back to an older save game that was a long way back, and then I just went... Console, SV cheats 1, host time scale 10. That's 10 times the speed of normal time. And all of the Source Engine is really good at handling it, so it even like speeds up the audio. Huh. So you get the actual, if you're listening, you can actually hear what the person's saying, but they're in like super rapid speech.
Wow.
Which is fantastic. Apparently, actually, there's a weird anecdote about this. I think in JP Le Breton's developer commentary on Bioshock, I think during Bioshock 1 or 2 testing, they sometimes would accelerate the time scale in order to test something. And they also had the same thing where the sounds would speed up. And the sounds for the Big Daddy's groans are, I think, somebody in the studio actually just going like, bleh, 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 but slowed down massively.
Oh, no,
so they speed it back up and just hear the person go, bleh, bleh, bleh.
Awesome.
But yeah, I'd love to know what the actual command to do this in Mass Effect is.
I would
love to skip some of that stuff.
I've never completed Mass Effect 1, and therefore never played any of the other Mass Effect games. Yeah. And I keep trying. I've tried a couple of times now, and I always get put off by the combat because I don't enjoy the combat in Mass Effect 1. I like combat, but I don't think that's very good. And the fact that it's 30 to 35 hours long, and it's a little bit slow to convince you of what's cool about that world, and I'm just some asshole with a shit gun going down to planets. But actually, if that thing exists, then I will go back and play that game.
It might not help in combat. It might mean enemies kill you like 10 times as fast without you being able to respond.
You want the option that Mass Effect 3 gives you to have just purely easy combat.
Yeah,
I think that's
really cool. Some people are like really object to it, but I think it's great to have an option where just like people who just don't want to do the combat or can't do the combat, let them still see the story.
Yeah, definitely. Especially if you specialise as a sniper in Mass Effect 1, because you're shit, basically.
They become amazing in the second of
despite
game.
Somehow reaching the rank of commander, aren't able to shoot at all, and your reticule waves up and down wildly while the rest of your AA companions just die.
Fabian says, "Dear Crate and Crow Battalions, in a recent episode you were discussing Valve's SteamOS and mentioned games running on PC, Mac and Linux at some point. Please don't take this the wrong way. I really don't want to be a fucking annoying pain in the ass, but I have to address this. It has often been my gripe with the games industry that people substitute PC for Windows. As I see it, the PC is a specific hardware combination, historically speaking the IBM-compatible PC. Today, the distinction is only useful when distancing the system from mobile devices or consoles. And with the current hardware in the PS4 and Xbox One, even that is becoming less true. Windows, Mac, OS X, and Linux all run on PCs. Additionally, the Mac is a PC these days. Since Apple switched to Intel, Mac hardware is pretty much indistinguishable from other PC hardware. Linux runs on it fine, especially since most modern Linuxes also boot via EFI. Therefore, when referring to games, I'd say that they run on Windows, Mac, or Linux. The only reasons why Linux doesn't work as doesn't work on the AMD powered hardware in the consoles is A, because of their lacking drivers, which Sony and Microsoft will keep close to their chests, and B, because of some proprietary magic when booting the things. Small point, but I think it is getting more important since Valve is trying to finally make Linux a feasible gaming platform. SteamOS is basically Ubuntu, by the way. You can even have a peek at the source, I think he means peek as in look, at the source code from their experimental repository. Best wishes from a fellow PC gamer since the 286 podcast, mostly about Linux, and journalist on IT security and at a big German computing magazine. Have another drink, you need it after I just bore the fuck out of you. And thanks for reading, everybody!
Yeah, cool.
Yeah, I agree with him. Mm. We should say Windows, Linux, and Mac.
Yeah.
We know the difference. It's just, we speak wrong. Yeah.
Tom, as someone who works for PC Gamer, do you feel that you actually work with Windows Gamer? Or?
Well, created a feature on gaming with Linux recently for the site. And it was Craig Pearson, who's an ex-PC Gamer guy, and he installs Linux every year, annually, to see if it's kind of gotten better as a gaming platform than it was the previous year. And it's really simply a matter of usability. The problem isn't so much that everyone assumes that Windows is ubiquitous. The problem is that all games are designed to work with that system, and there's an adaptation process that then happens, that has to happen to get that stuff onto Linux. And there are, like, Craig booted up Linux, Steam Linux, which works extremely well, but there's an extremely limited selection of games on Steam. And like, there are ways to make a lot of these games work, but if you're looking at, like, mass market people just seeking entertainment, this stuff has to be accessible and quick and easy to install. And things like, you need storefronts like Steam or other storefronts, it doesn't necessarily have to be that, to make it accessible. And it's just not there yet. Like, Linux is absolutely viable, and evidently Valve think it's viable because they've made it the basis of their new OS, but they've got to make it accessible to everyone, and it's got to be, it can't be like an enthusiast's game anymore. Linux, if it's going to grow, it's got to be, Valve have got to make it easy to use.
I have to routinely tell people that Gunpoint is on Windows and not on Linux or Mac. And I used to say Gunpoint's on PC, and then I thought, oh well, that's not technically true, I should say Windows because that's really what it's on.
Yeah.
I've since learned I shouldn't say that because I found out a load of people thought that it was only on Windows 8.
Oh, shit.
Because that's the only time people say the word Windows is when they're specifying that it only runs on the latest Windows thing. People just hear it as, oh, it only runs on like that Windows 8/Surface/Windows Phone thing. Yeah, okay. I'm just going to say PC. I don't care if it's technically wrong. Like, people know what I mean when I say PC.
I think it's a great time for Linux now. I think, with Valve, what Valve are doing. Ever since Valve announced that, you've seen a lot of people talking about, oh, we're going to make a Linux port of our game all of a sudden. Like, there is real interest in making this work. And
I think the Humble Bundle kind of led that charge. So, like, that's like, you know, Humble Bundle just immediately made over $1 million with the first one, and you can only get in one if you're on Linux. Yeah. Very, very suddenly, a very large number of people are making Linux versions of things. Like, absolutely. Oh, shit!
Yeah.
And Chris Remo was saying that is true of Double Fine. Like, that's the main, they are making almost all of their games for Linux now, and it's partly because of the Humble Bundle and partly because of the increased demand for Linux that has come because of the Humble Bundle.
Mm. I don't understand enough about anything, but is the main stumbling block DirectX? Because that's made by Microsoft, whereas OpenGL was the open source equivalent, and everyone moved away from using that.
Is awful. All I've ever heard from experienced programmers is just endless bitching about OpenGL, about how erratic it is and how it behaves differently on everyone's machines.
Isn't the best thing that Valve could do to create an open equivalent of
their own API?
Yeah, which wasn't awful, but also wasn't DirectX. Like, because like Carmack continued with the EdTech engines to support OpenGL. When everyone else stopped, and it was because Carmack really wanted that openness. But surely if OpenGL was shit and that's what's putting people off it, then you need a thing there which works on Linux but is not shit.
I think was AMD that proposed something called Mantle, which is supposed to be an alternative to DirectX as well for porting. This is more about porting games from consoles over to PC architecture, Windows architecture. But I think that's an interesting point, actually. Like, DirectX Is it owned by Microsoft, isn't it?
It was developed by Microsoft, yeah, the other ones that...
That's the source of their monopoly on the market then, if that's the technology by which...
Pretty much. And they've tried to use it as a selling point. Like, they tried to use it as a selling point for, was it Vista, I think, came shipped with DirectX 10? Mm. And so if you wanted to run a game...
Had to be on Vista.
Mm. Yeah, that was powered by DirectX 10 and used those features, then you had to have Vista. And it didn't work, because... the DirectX 10 feature set wasn't radically different from what DX9 offered. And that
Just
kind of
Cause 2 was a Vista exclusive.
Yeah.
And then and they said, oh, it's because it, you know, DirectX 9 can't handle it, can't be done with DirectX 9, and then people just modded it to work DirectX 9. No graphical difference whatsoever.
Yeah.
Complete bullshit. Ivory Tusk says, hello, Creighton Crowkens or Crow Barbie Girls.
Yes! That's great.
It's a stretch. I was astonished and delighted to hear you talk about Jump and Bump in episode 14. I always foolishly thought I was the only one who played it. For me, the game exists as a faint memory in the late 90s of surprisingly violent cuteness, low-res CRT displays, and the discovery of that games are made up of .ini files. Did you know that its one-level layout was saved as an ASCII file? I remember editing in secret passages and replacing normal ground with icy surfaces. I could also have edited the level image to match, but the prospect of dominating my friends when they came around the house was too tempting. Which brings me to my question. Well, at least closer to it. I have always been the lone gamer, but every time I did try to play with my friends, I somehow bounced off the different skill levels of my fellow players. Either it was an eccentric gem that only I played, like Jump and Bump, my friend eviscerated me in StarCraft, or, as in the case with Counter-Strike, we couldn't even defeat the one proficient player in the group if we all teamed up together. it's why I prefer cooperative games. How do you deal with the very different skill levels when playing with friends? I guess you games journos are at least mostly at some lowest common denominator.
Hey,
that's accurate, I think. Yeah, it's about right.
Skill-wise. Still, isn't there always one person who can make or break the game for you? Keep doing what you're doing, Ivory Tusk.
Yeah, it's definitely true. I mean, it's still true amongst us. I think probably... Maybe, I don't know what it is in civilian life nowadays, but amongst game journalists, like, there's probably, like, a base level of competency at kind of most games. I don't think there's, I mean, I'm certainly not good at games.
Mm.
I don't think most of the people I play with are that good. They have their specialities, but I think there's probably it's the same kind of...
There's a proficiency that shares across games in terms of just enough experience. Well, a familiarity. That you will be decent. Yeah.
You're not going to play with a mate if all your mates are games journalists, and you're not going to play with a mate who just doesn't understand how to move the mouse in a first-person shooter. That's not going to happen. But even that being said, like, it's really... matchmaking is still difficult because you get in games with people who are just super, super fucking good at Counter-Strike, and you end up matched against a team who just totally destroy everybody on your team apart from that one player who has brought up everybody else's kind of average standard. Still happens.
Yeah, there's, I think the sort of minimum, the lowest common denominator mentions is basically that we're all probably capable of getting through a given single player game. So we can all complete a game of some kind. But there is a big, like, skill differential on multiplayer games. And what's interesting, I think, is that it's usually different from game to game. Hmm. Like, I think there are certain games where one of us will be better at it than others, and then in the next game they'll be rubbish, and, you know, there'll be someone else who dominates. And so it's very much like the kind of skill set, both in terms of practice and in terms of what things the game draws on. Like, I'm quite good at Half-Life 2 Deathmatch, and that's like the only multiplayer game I'm good at. Graham's good at Counter-Strike. And, like, I can sort of, I don't know that for everyone, but for those two examples, I can think of certain skill sets that kind of explain that. Like, I'm not good at, very quick, accurate movements. I'm not good at sniping. I can't rapidly move my cursor exactly to someone's head and shoot them. And Counter-Strike's kind of all about that. Like, it's whoever does that first wins. Whereas the gravity gun in Half-Life 2 Deathmatch is very much about prediction. It's all about there are physical objects traveling at a constant velocity through a space, and you have to know when it hits that wall, it's going to bounce off at this angle, and you have to be ready to catch it. And you have a way of defending yourself against attacks. Like, no matter how fast the other guy is, if you know when he's going to fire, you can catch it because you're ready for it. And then you can fire it back, and how you fire it back also depends on how effective, also determines how effective your attack is going to be, because if he's expecting you to fire it back in that direction, he'll be catching it. But if you rebound off a wall, or if you jump and fire it at his feet, then you have an advantage on that. And so, the thing I enjoy in multiplayer games is always about psychology and about moment-to-moment prediction, not like, rational thought and not like actually thinking, who is this guy and how am I going to predict what he's going to do, what's he going to do next? But that kind of intuitive thing where sometimes just running around a multiplayer map with a rocket launcher, I'll think, I'm going to fire a rocket at that corner. There's no one there now, but I've played this map like 1,000 times and quite often a guy comes around that corner. And sometimes you just get a shot like that and it just, that wins you the game. So those are the only thing in multiplayer I have any knack for is psychological prediction on a moment-to-moment basis based on intuition and playing something 1,000 times. And everything else I'm bad at.
When you bring up Counter-Strike as just purely a Twitch thing, I think that's interesting because I was thinking about this today as I was getting destroyed in a Counter-Strike game. But I think that like the first hurdle to Counter-Strike is all that Twitch stuff. And because that's your only means of interacting with that game when you're a new player, is to be quicker at spotting people, because you don't know the levels. But as soon as you play it enough, your map awareness becomes actually of much greater strategic value. And then that actually becomes the dominant thing. And maybe, I mean, obviously, if somebody is just better at putting the cursor over your head and making it explode than you are, then they will still probably win most bouts. But you can still get into a position where your team wins. As by just knowing those maps better, and the problem is you never get to that stage as a new player because you're destroyed continuously for ages and ages and ages by people who just know the maps and are also better at the game. Just per se.
The times when I really feel like giving up in Counter Strike is I often get into situations where I just kind of I often take like a weird route or I go some crazy place or I just wait for like 30 seconds in a strange spot. And so I get the jump on someone, and it's awesome. I feel like I've won the game. I've got the jump on someone, and I come out behind them, and I spray them with my assault rifle, and they feel the spray hitting them. They turn around and shoot me in the head. Oh, my fuck, sir. Yeah. Sometimes I'm just, like, I empty my whole clip at them. And
I still find that very... And that's another thing which only comes with practice. Counter-Strike is really prone to very unintuitive things happening in combat, because so much of it is based around the accuracy of your weapon and what you're doing when you fire it.
Yeah.
And it might be that your cursor is on their face and you're a foot away from them when you fire an entire clip into them. And yet actually the trajectory of those bullets may somehow curve themselves around that person's head and find themselves in a bin somewhere down the alley. But there's no way you can know that until you've acclimatized yourself to that game. So it's weird. It's just a matter of being able to put amount of time into a game and feeling like you're succeeding. That's the kind of barrier to people getting into the things.
I do think for friendly games, more games should support some kind of handicap system where, you know, if I'm playing against you and you're way better at this game than me, we can just play with where you have a handicap. You just do 30% less damage and then we see how that works. And if I keep hitting you, then we up it a bit.
Yeah.
If you're a different skill level to a friend, you just can't play the game with a friend. That's just the end of your time unless you can play it co-op.
I find this completely unforgivable in co-op games, like, for example, Diablo 3. For example,
oh god, yeah,
impossible to play with your friends that might be 10 levels lower than you, or even 5 levels if you're a very, very high level, and that's just unforgivable.
This problem has been solved by City of Heroes in 2004.
Because you may have the same skill level as people,
quite right? And it's raw numbers according to the leveling curve. That's complete bollocks. But this has been solved. Like, there's nothing wrong with leveling lower players up to your safety.
Borderlands does it, right?
Borderlands does it. Guild Wars 2 does it extremely well. Mm. In fact, if you're a level 60 character, you go to a low level area, it levels you down to level 10. So you have new skills, you have more variety of skills, but you are as powerful as everyone else in that area. And this, like, it's unforgivable that in a game like Diablo 3, which is supposed to be a session-based co-op game, you have to have the greatest possibility of having co-op. You have to maximise the possibility of having co-op partners that can play with you.
Marsh and I tried. I wasn't very far into the game. I was like level 7. I was that early on. I was still in Act 1, but I just could not play with Marsh, who was level 1, because he was just starting out with me the first time.
Punch things with your left fist or your right fist, according to the right
if he did the sections of the game for me, he just got killed instantly. If I did the sections of him, then I just kind of walked along behind him, because if I killed everything, then they would just die instantly. He wouldn't get any XP, and it was no fun for me anyway.
It's terrible. Like, the game should level Marsh up to 7, and it doesn't have to give much new skills at that point. Just needs to make his base attacks that he has powerful enough to compete, and then give you an XP bonus in order to let you unlock things faster. Like, this stuff has been done by many games before. Like, it's not a hard problem to solve, I think. So that stuff's really unforgivable. in co-op, especially.
In terms of, like, competitive games, yeah, I'm just never going to play a fighting game with Nathan Brown, Rich Statton, or Owen, ever. And
too many skills there.
Yeah, there's just, like, and it became kind of exemplified within our little community when people started playing Dota.
Yeah.
And there's just a bunch of my friends who play Dota and love Dota, and I kind of want to get into Dota, but in order to play with them, I've got to play that game for 800 hours.
Yeah.
Otherwise, I feel guilty about the fact I'm ruining the game for them.
Yeah, exactly.
Because the economics of it are such that my presence and my shitty presence are literally causing them to lose and have less fun.
But I think the thing with Dota is that it has nothing to do with how good you are at games generally, is that that's such an arcane system unto itself that
you gotta learn it.
Everyone has to put 800 hours into that thing.
It's kind of true with fighting games as well. I mean, there's a certain amount of, like, a Twitch manual thumb dexterity there, which transports between games and stuff like that. But each game does have a different move set from other games, and so you just gotta put the time in order to learn the move list and learn the counters to all your opponents.
I don't know anything about it, but it's quite interesting to see that a bunch of StarCraft players are going straight to Hearthstone, which, as far as I understand it, is, like, completely different. Just totally different skill set, but obviously has interesting counter and counter logic. I think Artosis, the StarCraft 2 commentator, won a tournament in Hearthstone.
He won the BlizzCon. Wow. He won the BlizzCon Hearthstone tournament. Yeah.
Wow, you wouldn't think any of those skills would be transferable to a card game.
I think it's a way of thinking. Like, if you're good at chess, you can probably be decent at checkers. Like I think it's that kind of thing, rather than specific mechanics.
And actually, it's very interesting. I like to kind of watch that match and try and understand it, because when you listen to Artosis commentate a StarCraft match, it sounds for all the world like he is better than all of them. and he's not at all disrespectful. He absolutely worships these people, and he'll tell you why what they're doing is genius. But the whole point is, when they're doing something genius, he knows why it's genius, he knows why they're doing it, and he knows that they should do it. And when they do something wrong, he'll tell you it's wrong, like, 7 minutes before it loses in the match. He'll say, no, he shouldn't be doing that, because this is, like, clearly this combination is not going to work. And he's already, not even, like, using his knowledge of the map, he'll using his observer view.
Yeah.
He will say, this player has already seen on the field that the enemy player has this, so he should already know he shouldn't be building Colossi right now. It's not going to counter this effectively. And then they'll die. So, and then Artosis will play in these tournaments, and he'll lose in, like, the first round. And you always think, damn it. He seems to understand everything, like, way better than everyone else. Why is he losing?
This is just that,
and I think there's just a level of micro that's kind of, like, if you are not 19 years old and playing 16 hours a day, you are never going to be quite as sharp as these guys, and your micro is never going to be that good. And I guess Hearthstone doesn't have that, so his, like, deeper understanding of strategy and tactics is maybe winning him that. And MattVic79 says, "Hi, nail shut box and leverage device." We're getting a lot of these, like, descriptive,
literal. Yeah.
So far, none of them been exactly the same. I am a budding game developer with what I believe is a great idea. I have a reasonable grasp of how to write code and intend on using GameMaker to create my game. My artistic skill seems to be letting me down, though. What development resources did you find most beneficial when creating Gunpoint? Yes, creating Crowbar. How did you create Gunpoint? And why?
Well,
I'm a one-man band doing this with my spare time, so cost is a major issue for me. I want to do it all myself, as relying on other people gives me the willies. Thanks a bunch, Matt.
That's it.
Well, I mean, you should answer first.
Yeah.
No.
So Martin and Graham have also marked this question as one they can answer. I kind of can't help him with his exact question, because he wants to do it all himself. And one of the best decisions I ever made with Gunpoint was giving up on doing the art myself. Because I was in a similar situation where I can kind of do code, and I thought I had a good idea. And when I tried to do art, I did give it a go. But my art was shitty, and that was only really half the problem. The other half of the problem, it would take me fucking hours to do a shitty sprite. Like, to do that, like, really, really awful main character was, like, 3 hours or something. One sprite. So if I was going to animate something, like, 15 frames for him to climb up a wall or something, that's going to be several days' work, and it will still be shit at the end of it. And I started to realize I was really, like, this is a problem I can't solve myself. I need to get someone else in on it. I also didn't have any money to spend on it, and so when I asked for artists, I didn't even know if I was going to charge money for the game, so I didn't offer anyone money. I said, hey, this might be a free project, so only apply if you're interested in doing it for fun. But if we do sell it, then we'll do a profit share thing where you get a percentage of our profits, and that's what we did in the end.
There are lots of free resources. for people making games, art resources. There's, I think it's called Glitch.
Yep, it's that's the thing. I flagged the question.
Right, yeah, they were, it wasn't terribly successful, MMO. It was shit, says Graham.
It's a good job Nika isn't here on this podcast.
It was very good. Anyway,
pleasant as a concept.
Didn't do very well, but they've now released all of their art assets completely for free for anybody to use in any kind of project. And there's probably quite a few different ventures like that. I'm sure you could find other things. There is, if you sign up to the Reddit Game Dev sub, there are regular posts about there for how programmers can make their own art assets, kind of written by other programmers who've made their art assets, and they're quite good basic introductions to paint programs and things like that, and how to kind of do kind of quick fixes to make things look acceptable. And there's also, if you do have any money to spare, you can also go to things like the Unity Asset Store and buy up packages of assets, pre-made assets. Obviously, they will appear in other games as well. You don't get exclusive rights to them. But they are fairly cheap, what they are, and you can get a whole bunch of, and you can outfit an entire game that
way. I think there's a fair amount of free stuff there as well, like of varying levels of quality, obviously, but if you just want to get something in there to show how it looks.
I don't know if there's a licensing issue between things being sold in the Unity Asset Store and using them in Game Maker. Would you be able to just use those assets regardless of which program you made those games in?
I don't know what they'd have that would be portable to Game Maker, because
if it's just 2D graphics, you could just strip them straight.
Yeah, do they have 2D stuff on the Asset Store?
Oh yeah. Loads of textures and stuff.
Yeah, I don't know. I guess you have to look into the terms and conditions or whatever.
Hmm. But I mean, that's potential.
That's what's great about the Glitch assets is they really start under a Creative Commons license, but it's CC0, I think it's called, which is basically waive all rights whatsoever. Yeah. We renege our copyright entirely. And that game was set inside the imagination of, I think, 11 giants? It might have been 12 giants or 8 giants, but so it's got quite a broad set of different, types of artwork and art styles and objects, and it was also designed that players could be very expressive, and so you could design your own avatar, so it's got individual eye pieces and nose pieces and that kind of thing. And if you're starting out making your first game and you don't have an art ability, then you shouldn't be trying to make a game which is going to take you years. You should probably be aiming to make a game which is going to take you a shorter amount of time, and you release it for free, and therefore it's okay to make a game which looks maybe a little bit like Glitch, a game which no one really played, for Nika. and put that out there, and then use that to attract artists. And I think it's okay to team up with people and work for free and then do a profit-sharing thing at the end, and that's true regardless of what medium you're in. If you want to be a comics writer, that's what comics writers do. They go and find people stupid enough to draw their comics for free and then build a career out of that.
Thanks for ruining my career as a freelance game artist. That's great.
No worries.
Profit share is an excellent deal for artists, though, in the current climate.
If the game's successful. That's it for questions. We've answered, as many as we'd marked. not all of them by any means. We should stop there.
If you want to send us more questions, you can. You can send us questions@creightandcrowbar.com.
Or on Twitter, @creightandcrowbar.
Or you can tweet us individually.
@PentadAct for me, Tom Francis.
I'm @Gonas, Graham Smith, GONNAS.
I'm @MarshDavies, DAVIES.
I, Tom Senior, I'm @PCGLudo, and that's LUDO.
Thanks for listening, everybody!